Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Okay, I may need significant help to get through the program this evening. There is a very specific broadcast term for a day like this, or a week like this. There's a reason folks take vacations during this week of the year. This is what you call a slow news day. Slow, slow, slow. But you know what? There's plenty of interesting stuff out there. That just means you have to work a little bit harder to find it. This is a chance to sort of, because there's no, Is there a new breaking the Tiger Woods story? No, I didn't think so. That's how slow the news day is. But no, just nonetheless, there's stuff to occupy our attention. Plenty good as it is. A little bit of breaking news out there today. It's a sad day in family values land. It's a grief-stricken day for family values repiglickens. One of those model marriages, one of those Ozzie and Harriet Ward and June marriages, has come to an end. Yes. It has been confirmed that Karl Rove and his wife, Darby, have obtained and had finalized a divorce. Yes, I know, it is sad, but it is also, well, it's just true. Carl and Darby Rove, model couple, a pair who fairly defined traditional family values merge, have called it quits. They've been married since 1986. My God, they were married for almost 24 years. And they've got one son to show for it. And now they're bailing. Really? I mean, I'm not going to sit in a glass house and throw stones or anything, but, you know, the statistics out there say that if you make it past year five, you've got a better than average chance of staying married. 24 years? And a fine, upstanding follower of Christ like Darby and Karl Rove, and they just done? You know, I think we probably need legislation out there. We need a real Defense of Marriage Act. We need a Defense of Marriage Act out there that will stop these offenses to traditional marriage. Why couldn't these two just stay on in a lifelong, loveless marriage that was a living hell for both of them? Why not? Of course, then again, you never know. One or the other may have been romping, and being as how it's Karl Rove, and they're kind of he's kind of reptilian, you don't know what he or Darby were a-romping with now, do you? According to a statement made by Dana Perineal to CNN,
the couple came to the decision mutually and amicably, and they maintain a close relationship and a strong friendship. There will be no further comment, and the family requests that its privacy be respected.
Bug spray. What right do they have to have their privacy respected when Karl Rove was an active participant in an ongoing assault on the private family matters of people all over this country for 8 long years? Just say it. No, that's the Republican Party. Do as I say, not as I do. Never mind the fact that I'm over here taking a big old pee on traditional family values and traditional Christian heterosexual marriage. Y'all just need to attend to your own affairs and let us sit over here and be as hypocritical as hell ourselves. Got the memo? Good. Good for you. That's nice. Almost 24 years and... nothing to show for it. Wonder who's getting the fabulous wagon wheel coffee table or the family Bible. Well, I'm sorry. I guess in the case of the Rove family, it would be the family Necronomicon. Maybe this is sleazy on my part, and I ought not be noting it. But we're dealing with hypocrites here, right? Juanita's broken out and gone comedy writer on us. Regarding Rove, does this mean George finally said yes? I have a feeling Juanita's at the top of her game tonight. Yes, Carl. Yes, 1,000 times yes. You had me at hello. Whoa! I'm sorry, that's just that was a full body shiver that just rolled over me. Yeah. But no, it's a little slow today, but I got a feeling there's plenty of stuff to keep us interested as we go along. A little bit of work having been done to note the fact that in the year 2009, get this. In the year 2009, according to the Washington Monthly, author Steve Bannon, 2009 saw Newt Gingrich be the show's most frequent guest of the whole year. Can you imagine that? It's 2009. Democrats have taken over the House. Democrats took over the Senate. Democrats took over the executive branch. And who was the go-to guy for Meet the Press? A worn-out, tired, corrupt, philandering political hack from Georgia who hasn't held office in over 10 years. That's the go-to guy for the for-profit media and that incisive program, Meet the Prestitutes. Not one time, Steve Bannon notes, not one time in 2009 did Meet the Prestitutes have the actual Speaker of the House on the program. Not one time in 2009 was any other Speaker of the House former on the program. It's, well, it could just, hey kids, what kind of time is it? It's howdy noody time. Maybe that's a possible new name for Meet the Prestitutes. Howdy noody. Well, that just sounds kind of sick and gross too, though, doesn't it? Howdy noody. Conjures all sorts of visions in your mind's eye that you just really don't want to see in the first place. Ugh. But we'll get through. We'll get through. Let's see. We'll go to the phones in a second. We'll just sort of open it up early and see what you guys find interesting this evening, because it is a bit of a slow news day. But a little dedication song
little dedication song for Darby and Newt out there. Yeah, this works. This is going out to Darby and Newt, former newlyweds, now divorcely unweds. Is that a word?
Say, oh no, who's this kinky so-and-so? You know, if you're into a little the burning eyeball action, you can look up the family history of Karl Rove and look up his daddy. Never mind. But yeah, a little long distance dedication going out to Karl and Darby. Your Haitian divorce, classic from. Steely Dan, we'll go to the phones and see what's happening. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yes, we're so sorry to hear about Satanish and his wife Rosemary. sorry.
That was good.
Don't know where that came from. Sorry about that. Yeah. I was going to say, who officiated? Jeff Combs?
I was thinking maybe Ted Haggard.
Well, yes, the Crystal Methodist. Yes, indeed. Well, you were talking a minute ago about the brave front that the boys over at Meet the Press put up. We saw this past weekend, well, we have Newt on there to represent the conservatives. We have Michael Bloomberg on here to talk about the independent. And for the Democrats, we have Deval Patrick. Who?
Yeah, what? Huh?
You got the governor of Massachusetts. Oh, joy.
Well, you know, it is the most liberal state in the union. They're almost communist up there.
Oh, he'll be happy. He could have had Rush Limbaugh to represent the Democrats. You know? I mean, remember now, David Gregory, who follows right along in his predecessor, media whore number one's plan to see if everything he can do to put the boys from the right wing radio business on Meet the Press permanently.
Well, you know what I find interesting though is that Newt was out there representing, so to speak,
yeah.
And he said we will run on an absolute pledge to repeal this bill, talking about the healthcare bill. Well, how interesting it is to hear him say that when, you know, he doesn't occupy any position of power whatsoever within the Republican Party except as some sort of, you know, lech emeritus.
Well, like I say, I think that we're going to find 2010 is going to be the year of watching the teabaggers see how many Republicans they can run out of the party.
Well, yeah, but the other side of that is that they got Mitch McConnell sat down to talk with ABC's Jake Tapper, and you know, Mitch McConnell actually, to the extent that he does more than draw his breath and his pay, Mitch McConnell actually occupies an elected office in the government as a Republican.
Well,
so Jake Tapper tried to nail him down on, and here's the question. Do you think that Republicans running for Senate in 2010 should run on a platform of vowing to repeal the health care reform bill should it become law? And will that be one of your first items should you regain control of the Senate, repealing what you guys call Obamacare?
It couldn't get him to answer.
And dead nut. He did everything. He slithered and squirmed and wiggled and wobbled as well or better than the average Repig Licking. You've got the comparison there, Luke. Office holder who actually has to run a campaign, not so crazy about the idea of saying we're going to run against health care.
Well, but you see also then our favorite politician of the last 24 hours, good old Jim Demented, you saw what he was saying a while back, is he needed some new kind of Republicans.
Yeah, oh yeah.
On the wall, and he wants to make sure he gets to stick around.
Yeah, he needs the current crop is not crazy enough to suit Jim Demented.
I was gonna say, oh god. Oh well, we found out a new catch line for CNN. All terror, all the time, 28 hours a day, 6-8 days a week.
Be afraid, citizen. Be very afraid.
I watched the other day, and it was it Frederica? And I can't think what her last name is.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
And I swear, for 2 hours straight, that all she talked about was the plane. The thing. And I'm just like, you know.
The plane.
World. I mean, oh, God.
The underwear.
I know. Well, you know, oh, talk about that. Well, I see we're either going to have two options now. Either, A, we're going to do the total recall body scanning, where I think we're going to have the wall-size X-ray machine, or we're going to now do what we used to joke about 4 or 5 years ago. It's time for nude airway. Everybody strip down, get on the plane. We'll get you your clothes down there on another plane, and they'll meet you.
See, I keep getting so much pushback on this. I think Speedos and flip-flops are the way to go if you're flying on an airline now.
I'm surprised that Branson over at Virgin Air, this would be a good idea. I'm surprised he hasn't gone with it.
Go figure.
It's crazy enough to work.
But you know what? There's some underlying stuff here. These new body scanners that, of course, use X-rays.
Between like four poles, and it's like, is lightning going to strike? What? You know?
Yeah, but beyond that, you know, there was that story that came out, a couple of weeks ago about what we now know about CT scans.
Yeah.
You know,
overindulgence.
Well, yeah, and the fact that you can't, you know, two identical machines performing the same identical computerized test can give off radically different radiation dosages, and the scientists now saying that we are going to have a cancer eruption in this country in about 20 years.
Oh, yeah. So many people have been, you know, run to, you get the CT, go get the MRI, go get the, you know, and we don't know what the long-term effects are.
But the thing is, though, the MRI is no more dangerous than standing next to a compass.
I know.
It's just magnetism. But here's the fun.
Everybody runs to it. Oh, we got to have it done. Yeah.
Here's the fun part, though. There was another study released that shows that the dye that they use for MRIs may actually be deleterious. But I'm getting a bit far afield. The question, though,
over in England.
Yeah. The question, though, is, knowing what we know about the use of X-rays, and it is, after all, radiation, and really, there's no such, it's not, even when it's used therapeutically for chemo and stuff, it's not good for you, generally speaking.
Yeah.
And we're going to radiate the bodies of everybody trying to get on an airliner?
Well, that's just like I always remember now, folks. Whenever they take your dental X-ray, why did they make you put that lead apron on? You know, it ain't because it's a fashion statement.
Right, or when they're X-raying your wrist to see if you fractured it in that polo match last week. Why does the technician stand behind a lead wall?
Oh, he just thinks it's pretty over there. You know how it is. Oh, got to go back to yesterday. Can I have a nominee for Moran Bundy?
Oh, you certainly may.
I didn't get here to all the show yesterday, so I don't know if you may. I think the Moran yesterday was John King. For sitting there when Mary Madeline was making those statements and saying absolutely nothing.
Well, see, I think that's what Sandra was alluding to, you know, when she kept asking me, did no one call her down after that?
Well, I can live with her saying it, you know what I mean? That's her job, so to speak. But the question is, John King standing there, and it's like, you just want to poke him in the stick and go, aren't you going to say something, dummy? Go on.
Yeah, because, you know, Carville was there, but he's not going to call down his wife.
You know, she's sitting there going, he inherited a depression, a recession, and inherited the attacks. And like you said, you know, it's like we talked about the G8 summit and all that. Yeah, no one would have imagined them using flying. Every time I used to hear Condoleezza Rice say that, I just screamed at the TV. Oh. I'm saying, well, then why did you all stay when the G8 summit? Why did George get to stay on the battleship all the time?
Right. Why was George on the boat?
Okay. Okay. I saw that somebody turned over a rock and 6 more months Tom Friedman popped up again.
No, really?
Yeah, he must have a new book out for sale.
I'm still getting over William the Bloody Crystal and Abdul Matulab is all lawyered up now.
But you know, 6 months Friedman, every time you turn around, he shows up to every issue 6 months too late, and he claims he's the one that discovered it. You know, something about him, I just always wait for somebody to really just expose him. You know, but, okay, let's get on to yours and my favorite subject.
Oh, yes, do.
Here we thought we didn't have a leader in the goof of the year in sports, and here Urban Meyer takes the gold.
Yeah, coming from behind the pack. Well, I don't know. Mike Leach is making a run for it here at the very end. You saw where he got suspended.
Yeah, I saw that one, but can you, now they don't talk about it. But can you imagine if you could really get Charlie Strong to say something? It's like, gee, Charlie, you took that job in Louisville. Now Urban says he's stepping down. Aren't you happy?
Yeah.
So you know he would have been the shoe-in for the job.
But you know, there's something at
what we still don't know.
Well, no, there's something at work there in the Urban Meyer situation. I've had some email exchanges over the last couple of days about it, and I'm kind of hesitant to go very far on it because we know these things to be facts. The guy has a brain disorder.
Yes, and if it had been the first one, you know, him retiring, fine. I could have said fine. You're out pretty much on top. You've got enough money. You ain't got to worry. You know, get whatever you have to.
You'll go and do motivation. You know, you can pick up where Bobby Bowden left off with the motivational speaking tour.
Or he's got a good personality. He could show up 6 months from now on TV, you know, doing the college for CBS or something, you know. He's a good talker. He could laugh.
Right.
He's got a good personality.
So the guy's got some sort of a brain disorder.
Yeah,
he's apparently developed some sort of a panic disorder. He is a micromanager type A, tighter than a golf ball.
Somebody yelled boo real loud, you see how he could jump.
Right, he's got runaway high blood pressure. Mm-hmm. And apparently, you know, I mean, the original story was that the family pulled an intervention on him.
Yeah. We want you to be around so I can see you when I turn 20, Daddy. You know.
Right. And he said, well, okay. And then turns around and, you know, tried to watch a practice and just came unglued. I can't leave this. They'll screw it all up.
Well, the thing that gets me is one or two little other facts that kind of bug me on this. He's a state employee. Doesn't he have to take a physical every once in a while? I mean, you know.
Well, but, forget about it, Jake. It's Chinatown. It's Florida, you know.
I know.
No offense to our Florida listeners.
Dr. Boom Bah. Yes, come in, Dr. Doctor. Breathe. Okay.
Okay, you're good. Yeah. Turn to the left. Cough.
I know.
Yeah, not even that, probably.
I know. Well, see, the other one, you know, and the other thing we're talking about, though, about getting out, it's like, okay, let's see. Jesus H. Tebow's leaving town. Your senior class is leaving, and apparently about 7 to 8 of your juniors have decided this is the time to go. Because they're wanting to get out and get in there before that rookie camp hits next year.
Yeah, you got some real serious 7 and 5 prospects next year.
So that's what I mean. I think big chunk of it is he didn't want to be there for a 9 and 3, an 8-4, or a 7 and 5 year.
With runaway high blood pressure, with a brain disorder, because that's the kind of stuff that could make him spontaneously combust on the sidelines.
I know. I mean, it's just one of them ones you just wonder when the president down there, well, like you said, I forgot where we're talking. Yeah, who just have to say, I'd really rather you go away for a couple of years to have you drop dead on the sideline, please. That would put a bad name, bad smell to the recruiting, you know.
But you know, that's it is kind of a wake up call, isn't it, Luke? I mean, for me, it transcends the issue of football.
It does.
Or college athletics.
It's one of those things. It's one of those jobs that. You know, you wonder when you see some of these guys, why did you get married, knowing the kind of life you lead? Because you ain't going to see your family 9 months of the year, if you're lucky.
But there's another little bit of toxicity running through this story, and that is in his statement, his second statement, I guess it was, he said there was some reference to, you know, is it going to be job, faith, family, or faith, family, job, and you're talking about he had his priorities screwed up or something. And that got me to thinking, because I remember one of the verses that Jesus H. Tebow wore on his eye black during the game there, and it was that verse that says from, you know, Romans or Flip-Floppians or Fine Corinthian, First Fine Corinthian Leathers 6:23 or whatever, I can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth me. In other words, because he is a hyperfundy, he is not allowed to show weakness.
You know.
Because that means that Jesus is asleep at the switch. This obtains beyond coaching. It doesn't matter who you are. As if this toxic fundamentalist prosperity gospel garbage is out there. And that is that If you're unable to measure up under the strain, then that's not an indication. That's an indication that your faith isn't enough. You know, because, you know, your faith is supposed to outstrip the cyst on your brain. The faith is supposed to outstrip your blood pressure.
Yep. It's supposed to take care of everything.
Right.
A lot of people die. You know, it's one of those things. Like I say, when you sit down and talk to someone like this, it's like talking to the brick wall. You know, you say all these things, and they just look at you like, huh?
Well, you know, and you know, there sits Jesus in the New Testament. Well, consider the lilies, consider the birds of the air. Neither do they spin nor do they toil. I think is the line from the King James Version. And. You know, that's Jesus. That's Jesus telling the morons that ran around with him, because they were apparently a dense bunch. If you bother to read the literature, take a break.
A little learning problem here.
Take a break. Take a breath.
Enjoy life.
Look at the flowers. Flowers are nice. Look at the pretty birdies. Birdies are nice.
Well, you know, it's like we were saying a minute ago. He's been doing that job okay there for 5 years. So figured he's making $3 to $4 million a year. If he ain't well set, then he's in trouble. You know, unless he's got a gambling problem like, you know, the bookie of the virtues, you know, he should have plenty of money put away.
The bookie of the virtues. That's good.
That's what I, every time I see him, I just imagine him with one of those poker you know, like the old poker dealers used to have. That little visor.
Yeah, the little green eye shade and the garters on the sleeves.
Every time I see Bill Bennett, that's the image I have. Just my mind fills those in with him. I see him standing there with a deck sitting there just flipping cards.
Counting flowers on the wall. Yeah, and the Statler brothers.
Two, three quick things. We'll get off here with other people on. Tonight, if anybody wants to see it or you want to set the tape machine, if you have Turner Classic Movies, at 8 o'clock, they are showing On the Waterfront.
Oh, nice.
Tomorrow night, I'll be sitting at home about 8 o'clock watching my favorite Bogart film of all, which is one of his little-known Bogart films called Deadline USA.
Oh, that's the one where he's the newspaper publisher.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a real good one, too.
And the thing is, if you watch it, just imagine, one's called The Day and one is called The Standard in the movie. Imagine The Day is the New York Times and imagine The Standard is the New York Post. And it fits right in with today. You'll understand that if you watch the movie. And Thursday, I will be sitting at home, hopefully by then, watching football.
Yeah, see, that's New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
And then New Year's Day, of course, I've got the Gator Bowl to attend to. But you mentioned Bogart movies. One of my favorites being, and I can never remember the title of it, but it's one that he and Randolph Scott and, Errol Flynn all were punished by the studio by being forced to make this terrible, terrible film. And it's the one where Bogart plays the Mexican bandit. Complete with the sombrero with the little hanging fringe balls around it. Yeah.
Oh, shoot. I think I know which one.
There's a gold shipment for the Confederacy, and Randolph Scott's bringing it from California. Oh, it's just awful.
Well, had that one, and he had the one when he got punished. Well, I think it's because he got punished. When he had to do, the Dr. X movie. Oh, this is almost his one into almost his horror film movie. But you know what I mean? That's just what it was. Sometimes you realize what they used to do. But tomorrow they're also showing, I think it's later in the evening, they're showing Beat the Devil. And I can't remember what the third one is. Tomorrow's their last night of their Bogart retrospective.
And see, I don't get the channel at all, so darn.
I'm sorry. The problem with that movie is that's one of the few that's not out on DVD.
Is it not?
No. They've never put it out. It's one of those ones like that, so it's just... But, I thought they were going to show On the Waterfront tonight, and it's like, say, when you watch that film, just remember, I think it's Brando, Carl Malden, Lee J. Cobb, and it was like Rod Steiger's first film. When you see that movie.
Oh, it's an undeniable classic.
I mean, it's one that if anybody ever wanted to be an actor, it's the one you have to watch to understand the system. Because there's four giants of their day. You know, and it's what they want you to just kind of look at you after you, you know, if you watch it all that through, just go, how's your old game shaping up for Friday?
You know, I just, I feel so icky about this thing because we've been set up as the bad guy to break Bobby Bowden's heart.
The Bobby Bowden's farewell tour, yes, indeedy. I hope y'all, well, at least hopefully y'all are getting a nice big paycheck out of this, so, you know, at least somebody gets some money somewhere. You know, I'm going to tell them, cause they ought to be paying y'all some extra money to go do this. I mean, this is not playing the sacrificial lamb. Like you say, this is being cast as Judas Iscariot.
Oh, it is. It is. We're just... There's no way... I look for us to lose, frankly.
Oh, one thing quick back going to Urban.
Yeah.
Now with this, your question is, Cincinnati versus Florida. Who really cares one way or the other? Go see who's more depressed.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. Although I'll be rooting for Cincinnati for all I'm worth. I mean, you know,
well,
Big
East. But
and so, hey, and so far isn't the Big East the Big East is representing pretty credibly, aren't we?
Oh yeah. Well, we see last night that holier than thou Rick actually found a team that like you say, he was playing out of the SEC so he could beat somebody. You know, so.
Yeah, who did they take down?
They took down Boston College.
Yeah, no, that was USC. Did Boston College?
Yeah, you're right. bust.
I sat there and watched. I can't believe it. I sat there and watched the highlights.
Oh, I sat there and watched most of the game. I can't think of it all of a sudden. God, my brain's going bad.
But, you know, Pitt took care of UNC. And, let's see, who...
Well, Clemson took care of Kentucky. I tell you what, when you see that...
Yeah, and I was rooting for Kentucky, too.
You're sitting there going, you still can't understand why C.J. Spiller wasn't at the awards. Because, I mean, he is...
Well, he was his... Look, Mark Ingram got it because Mark Ingram's playing for Alabama. If there was any justice at all, it would have been Gerhardt out of Stanford or C.J. Spiller. Yeah, it's rigged.
Yeah, but that's okay. All right, but let me let you go and talk to some other people, and I'll talk at you next week. So you're just on to Thursday, and then repeats on Friday?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, no, then. Yeah, have a good weekend. Have a good start of the year. We'll have the blue moon.
Oh, that's true. That's true. It is right now. The moon is waxing gibbous, is it not?
Oh, is it the second blue moon in the cycle? Is that what it is?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
All right. You have a good evening. I'll talk at you next week.
All right. Take care, Luke. Bye now.
See you. Bye.
That's Luke calling from East Tennessee, and lest people think that this is a football discussion, which it kinda is or was. There's something at work in the Urban Meyer saga that sort of transcends football. And that is this question of how much do you ask of a human being? And how much does a human being ask of himself? And do the people around that individual's life have the right to say something when the individual, I mean, look, whether it's drugs or booze or in Urban Meyer's case, just type A personality, obsessive compulsive disorder, whatever, however it's diagnosed, at what point in time does the American dream become the American nightmare? And to what extent does one of those public professions of faith play into it? Insofar as, you know, once you've played the I can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth me card, you can't lay down because then you're letting down Jesus or else you're either letting down Jesus or admitting that Jesus just, you know, isn't doing it for you. So, you know, that's a tough... And it doesn't just happen in coaching. This is the transformation of the American workforce. It's that thing that drives our buddy Joe Vecchio nuts. Every time he hears productivity, I remember Joe saying, every time I hear the word productivity is up in American workers, what that means is that they're working longer hours for less money and more time being taken away from, you know, their reality, which is, you know, hearth and home and family. But more and more of the American workplace has been invaded by this notion that, you know, thou shalt sacrifice all on the altar of work. And again, it's not just, you know, multi-million dollar a year coaches. It's, you know, it's the guy working down at the donut shop, too. And there's a difference between being dedicated to your craft and being willing to commit suicide for your craft. Because apparently that's more or less what Urban Meyer's family thought he was doing. They thought he was killing himself. And it's a hell of a spot to be in. I've resisted saying anything snarky about Urban Meyer, even though I don't like his little protege quarterback, you know, Jesus H. Tebow. And I'm no Gator fan. But there is something in his story that somehow or another seems, and perhaps it's just my twisted mind that's seeing it, but that somehow seems emblematic or paradigmatic of the entire American work experience. You know, we're getting our butts whipped by countries that take naps in the afternoon. We're getting our butts whipped by countries that think it's okay for a working stiff to have a beer at lunch and then go back to work on the assembly line. We're getting our asses handed to us by those folks. And yet we think if we work a little harder, if we just get to the grave a little bit quicker, for less money and less benefits, that there's some sort of a net gain in that? I'm a little lost. I really, really am. Back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob?
Yes?
Hey, it's Lee in Austin.
Hey, what's happening, Lee?
You know, and you threw me because I was all ready for some snarky comment because, you know, I've been going back to, like I said, when I saw where, you know, Kibo wept.
Yeah, well, that.
I still got to look that up. I think it's in John. But she threw me because, you know, I'm from a state that became a country because they allegedly whipped somebody's ass during a nap, you know, as far as Texas goes with the Sam Houston thing attacking during the siesta, you know.
Right.
And so, yeah, I'm totally off on everything. I'm sorry, you know, it's like, you know, I'm, you know, of course, Sue's like trying to give away scores that I'm TiVoing because I'm not looking because I'm off to work and yada, yada, yada. And, you know, I don't want to hear how Kentucky, Clemson are going right now or whoever it is playing today.
Right.
Anyways, no, I'm throwing myself off. Sorry. And also I'm the guy that just had a beer during lunch, you know, so,
good on you.
So I guess I would say how are things, and sorry, you've got me on football, if for no other reason, and I sent you a...
And by the way, I'm a Longhorns fan come national championship game.
I am too, and I sent you an email based on that about Nick Saban, or Satan, I guess you call him?
Yeah, Nick Satan.
What's a consonant between friends? But you know, they just freaking gave Mac Brown, they just kicked his ass up to freaking $5 million a season. Because he had a field goal kicker that was able to hit a kick, after they put a second back on the clock.
Right. Well, now, and remember, that happened two games in a row because he was within a gnat's rear end of losing to Texas A&M.
Yeah. And he does get exposed for his defense. Well, he should be exposed for his offense. Sorry. I'm wrecking this for everybody because it really is sports stuff, but I'm so bent out of shape, you know. I don't know what's worse, you know, if our national religion should be Christianity or Saturday football. But, you know, I'm torn because I don't like either one of them when you consider how much harm they do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. So, if I remember right, and I sent you, I think it was an email. But
yeah, I remember, you know, seeing it.
Saban was at $4.5 million, and they kick Mac Brown up to $5 million for winning the conference game. So he, you know, so after, you know, Saban does the thing that you talk about when he walks up to Mac Brown and goes, "Hey, is this yours?" How many more programs are going to get cut out of Alabama school?
Well, yeah, I mean, and the thing is, they don't. There's not an unlimited supply of money, and the defense to that, Lee, is always, well, you know, that's the alumni, that's the Athletic Booster Association, and that's salary guarantees and horse feathers. You know, the fact of the matter is the chemistry department goes begging, the biology department goes begging, the geology department goes begging. Lord knows the English and theater departments go begging.
Right, yeah. And at the same time, the universities themselves, they all get a ton of money from the government to do all kinds of defense contracts. I don't think I've ever shared this with you, but when I was a courier, and this will be so Simpsons, do you remember the episode where freaking Bart shoots a bird and he saves them eggs and they turn into lizards, and you know what I'm talking
yes,
about?
Yes, yes I do.
Okay, thank you. there was one day where I had a courier thing. I pick up a package, go to the airport, pick up the package, and I take it over to the UT entomology department. And I'm like, hey, so what's in this? And the guy's like, you dig crickets? And I'm like, not really. And he goes, well, you know, except for fishing or whatever. And I said, well, not really. And he goes, these crickets are special. And I'm like, oh, okay, you have my attention. How are these crickets special? He goes, they kill fire ants. And I went, you know, of course, this goes back to Alabama now, since that's where the fire ants came, if I remember right, off a container ship in Alabama. But that have been ravaging across the Southwest, and with the exception of TCU, that's why you don't have a horned frog anymore. But so he goes, you dig fire ants? I'm like, not really. He goes, these are special. I'm like, okay, how are they special? He goes, they kill fire ants. I go, what do you teach them? This is flea circus stuff. What are you talking about? He goes, oh, we alter them. And you remember how that Simpsons episode ends? It's like, well, what do you do? We've got, what is it, eels or snakes or something to eat the freaking lizards? And they're like, well, what do you do after that? You know, well, we'll come out with something else.
Yeah, to eat them.
Yeah, right. It's very much like the freaking bees in Brazil or whatever. That.
Well, it's the Hawaii paradigm where, the white people come in their ships and bring rats. So you introduce snakes to eat the rats. And then you have to introduce mongooses to eat the snakes. And then you got to, pretty soon you're up to elephants.
Yeah, pretty much. Of course, the last two things you just named, now you're talking about introducing Eastern mythology into stuff. Indian. I'm sorry, I saw more than one or two mongoose snake sites, because I lived in India, not from watching Rikki Tikki Tavi or anything like that.
Oh, Rikki Tikki Tavi is one of my favorite stories, though. My kids love it.
Oh, good. By the way, your kids were adorable.
Oh,
we're adorable. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, we said that too, and then we got sick of them. I'm on the Christmas Eve thing.
Yeah, you're back. You're not podcasting. You're backcasting.
No, I'm still time machining. So it's too much Dr. WHO, if you know what I mean. I'm still behind in the TARDIS, if you will. You know.
What's fun is to go back as I did, not on air but off air. Go back and listen to him do it the year before and the year before.
Oh, sweet. It's like marking an inch on the wall or whatever for the grocery.
That it's exactly what it is, Lee. It's the audio equivalent of doing precisely that. You can go back to before Ferg's voice starts changing and he's got this cute little voice.
Peter Brady.
Yeah, exactly. And now, and lo, there were shepherds lying in their fields by night abusing the sheep. Yeah.
Right, snickering the whole time. And using the sheep. All right, shut up, preteen. By the way.
Do you know how hard we had to work on Lo the Angel and the Angel of the Lord Came Upon Her? Do you understand how many takes that took before
and
I could?
Mary told the angel, get me a tissue.
Yeah,
oh,
right.
Sorry.
Yeah, Christmas is over. We can start having fun again. I mean, but no, seriously, we're dealing with a 14-year-old, okay, who was then a 13-year-old. He just turned 14. And every, it got to where I couldn't have him in the studio anymore because every time I said Dick Cheney, he came unglued.
Right, and on top of that, he wants to produce. But if I'm going to, and wants his own show, which, by the way, he should do, and I don't know what that costs. I don't know what it costs for bandwidth or whatever. But there should be some kind of 15 minutes with Ferg, and I don't mean to screw up your show. He's got to go do his own podcast and then get his own show, by all means. But he could spend three songs he likes, read a poem,
Now he'd do nothing but play Celtic Woman because he's all hot for that Chloe Agnew girl.
I don't know who that is.
You'll look him up on YouTube. It's a cross between River Dance and the Spice Girls. It's just...
That's pretty hot, actually.
Well, yeah, it is, but I'm not allowed to say that because I'm trying to be an adult here, Lee.
But no, I mean, he should follow that stuff. I mean, he should make some electronic art, And if I remember right, and I think it was about the time that they were about to do the drive-by truckers thing, didn't he want a banjo?
Yeah, he wants a banjo. He wants a banjo. He wants electric drums. He's learned probably the first six notes of classical gas. But, he's got the attention span of a gypsy moth.
Well, you know that joke, right? The difference between an onion and a banjo?
No.
Nobody ever cried while cutting up a banjo? Yeah, we used to have an accordion player in the band, and the way we would introduce him was essentially, hey, welcome our accordion player. Yeah, he forgot his accordion in the car, so he ran out to get it and came back. His window was smashed in, and somebody put a second accordion next to it.
God.
Yeah, try the veal. It's cool. It's cool to hear the kids. I'm never going to have any, and that's fine, too. I make what I make, and, as somebody who wants to be a good father and who has tried to be a good uncle, although all of my family are, you know, devout, and so they really don't want me around the nephews and nieces.
Yeah, at least not until they've got them good and religiously indoctrinated.
Well, suddenly things, you know, he's like, I love Jesus. I'm like, you're talking about the blue-eyed, blonde-haired Jesus on your wall? That one? That guy? Or are you talking about the guy did Jesus who used to play for the big red machine, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, so they're just like, you know, look, just come over, pick up the leftovers, and go away. You know, just don't show up for dinner. You know, it's just, you know, you're calling it solstice anyway, so just don't come. You know, so that's okay. I mean, it happens. And like I said, I pretty much got nothing. I just wanted to call and wish you guys a happy holiday and all that stuff. And things have been tight because there's stuff that should be in the mail, including some gas money and all that stuff, and I'm just fighting.
Don't you know. Sweat it, Lee. Don't sweat it. Don't sweat it. I understand.
Well, there's that thing when somebody was bitching about having to live month to month, and I suddenly looked up with, you know, shock. I went, what do you mean? There's another way?
Well, precisely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I've been doing this so long, I just thought that was the way it goes. You know, and I live in a town, by the way, here's one for you. Austin has a light rail that has never run yet, right? The thing's pretty much done. They can't get insurance. And, again, it makes me think of the Simpsons. Remember when Homer was driving the monorail in Springfield?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, the thing's never run because they can't get the insurance. At the same time, this stupid city turns around and announces they're like, we can't get the first rail running. So, of course, the people aren't going to necessarily want a second rail. So they came up with something cute called the Urban Streetcar, because it's going to run through the city's come up with $1 million to study whether or not we should come up with an urban streetcar. And it's just rebranding or renaming. But it's going to run through the east side. It's going to screw all of those property values when it actually goes in. Because, you know, those people are working 2 and 3 jobs a day to make their rent.
Yeah, but see, if you could get a national championship light rail crew going in Austin.
Oh, God. Well, that goes back to first you're going to have to win, and that means to win you're going to need a running game.
That's true. Oh, my God, that's true, too.
Good luck with that. Unless, you know, yeah, the Vince Neil Express will live in the past. Yeah. Or not? Why not the Randy McEachern Express, or whoever it was, or James? Oh goddamn! What was his name? Sorry, what was the guy's name that stepped in and became the big time Texas quarterback because the guy they had was not making it? Bobby Lane, because it wasn't getting done right about the time that Daryl Royal introduced the wishbone, and so he put Lane in as a substitute. You know, and it just turned out the guy figured it out. You know. But sorry, I am rambling.
No, that's quite all right. I'm just fascinated with sports, Southern sports culture, because I think it serves as an overall paradigm for how a lot of the South approaches life. You know, there's no gray. It's all win or lose.
Oh yeah.
And win at all costs.
Oh,
but
yeah.
But inevitably, the people who are hollering win at all costs are not the ones who are paying those costs. Because as you noted, Lee, the cost gets paid in the journalism department or the English department or the philosophy department.
It's getting paid on the backs of the rest of us.
Right.
Know?
I mean, the University of Texas, for instance, has a brilliant archaeology program. And a genius classics department.
Right, and archaeology in itself, though, pays nothing, you know, going out into it initially. You know, I don't know what a dig pays for a student. Well, I'm sure it pays.
Well, no, you can't get paid to go on them anymore. Not even anymore. I mean, the one that I was on, I paid to be on back in the day. And if you get, you know, if you're on one of those digs down in the Guatemalan jungle or whatever, there's an American archaeologist working in tandem with the local government and their head of antiquities, and he gets a grant, and he shares some of the cut with the state, with the national people, and then they bring in volunteers and interns and student assistants, and sometimes there's some college credit involved, but there's just not a lot of paid archaeology work. Now, in contract archaeology, like, for instance, say you're building a highway, and you want to do your site surveys so you can get the highway done, you know, those guys are paid. But, you know, there's not a lot of those jobs out there.
Are they archaeologists? And I don't understand enough about archaeology. But
yeah, they're contract archaeologists, and it's kind of the seedy underbelly of the profession, if it's still the way it was back when it was being talked about when I was thinking about pursuing it. You know, you can make money at it, but the whole thing is to get it dug, get it cleared away, and hope to God you don't find anything. And if you do find something, minimize it, write a paper about it, and then pave it.
That's not a pottery shard. That's a raccoon bone. Move on. I know what you're talking about, because that happened here, where they were trying to put in a new sewer line. And they found stuff, and I can't remember which tribe, and they went, hey, wait a minute, these are old ruins. Well, the freaking housing developments and the city, you know, the damn Chamber of Commerce, goes, oh, no, we got to get the sewer line through based on the EPA. But here, I'll tell you what, here's $6 million. We will do a dig after we get this freaking, you know, sewer line through. Now build you some more houses.
Exactly. Let me turn this back just for a minute to the sporting world, and we'll go up the road a little ways to Lubbock. And
Mr. Leach?
Yes, Coach Leach. You know, this
flying Walenga offense?
Well, yeah. this guy's a character. You know, he takes it when the season's over, he takes off for a month in February and does things like going to rugby matches in Wales. Which, you know, cool. I mean, I kind of respect that. Or goes off and learns something that has caught his fancy and fascinates him. But now this is just bizarre. I don't know if you've seen this or not, but Mike Leach has.
Oh, I know. I know.
He's filed a petition for a temporary restraining order against his own university that would let him coach in the Alamo Bowl on January 2nd.
No, I hadn't heard about that. I knew that they were. They were denying or going to come up against they were saying, the accusations you're talking about. Wrong angle, wrong perspective, point of view, yada, yada, yada.
And, this thing is going to be heard tomorrow morning at, like, 8:30 Central Time in 99th District Court in Lubbock.
Sorry.
I know.
That's funny. I've been to Lubbock, so you know.
And it all has to do with the fact that the son of an ESPN sports analyst, Craig James, who was one of the prancing ponies or whatever of SMU 1,000 years ago when they were handing out $100 handshakes at SMU. You remember SMU got their football program killed for that.
Oh, totally. That was under, oh, goddamn, what was his name? He was at Iowa for a little while. Oh, I can't think of that guy's name because they shredded Texas in the Cherry Bowl. By the way, and I'm getting off, I'm sorry, you just totally threw a shining object in my path and I went for it like a barracuda. Because SMU looked brilliant in the bowl with that true freshman quarterback.
Yeah, they did. They looked really good.
With June Jones, who turns around programs.
Yeah, he did everything except the Atlanta Falcons.
Well, some things are just unfixable, sir.
That's true. But, you know, the idea, and I guess they're saying that Leach was punishing Adam James, who is a receiver, because he had a mild concussion. So he made him stand in the dark in a corner. Yeah, but Leach then turned around and said, I'm trying to take this head injury stuff seriously. We kept him inside, out of the weather, while the team went and practiced. I didn't want anything to happen to him.
Do you lock the closet?
Oh,
turn the lights off?
Let's see. A person close to James with direct knowledge of the situation contends the player was twice forced to stand in a small dark place while the team practiced. The person spoke to the Associated Press on the condition of anonymity because of the sensitive nature of the complaint.
Oh, okay. I'm not trying to be a smartass. But I'm just like, okay. But you're like, dark closet. I'm going, that's what George Jones on his early Mercury records used for a sound chamber when he would record. A dark closet. I kid you not. They flip the light switch off or flip it on and then turn it back off. And he knew within 3 seconds the track would start and then started singing something like, you know, Ain't No Bunny in This Deal or Why Baby Why.
Oh, where's my George Jones greatest hits when I need it?
That's in the box of stuff I didn't send you. I've got a 2-disc set of the Mercury ears for you.
Oh, man.
So it's coming. It'll take a little while.
Yeah, I'll be watching.
But it's coming. That, and by the way, since I should ask you, do you have any of the DVDs of the Prophet Hicks?
No, I generally just watch them on YouTube. And
okay, then there's 2 of those as well.
Oh, beautiful.
I just didn't know if you had them. I've got one called Bill Hicks Live, and then I've got the other one called Bill Hicks Sane Man.
Those are both brilliant.
They're excellent, and it's and Live has his HBO special, his Montreal comedy special, and then something he did over in England about the time that Johnny Major had just gotten his ass kicked out of office. Not out of Tennessee Loop, different Johnny Major.
Right.
But, which, by the way, I love flipping on Luke because I know it's about to be, you know, an SEC update. So, you know, it's just, I miss my Horn family. I mean, I know I catch you guys. I just don't see y'all when I should. So.
Well, but you're out there engaged in the increasingly difficult American pastime of trying to stay alive, Lee.
Yeah. Could you just refer to me as our idiot cousin in Texas?
Well, no, I don't think so. That's not very nice. but you being a musician, are you familiar with Vic Chestnut?
No, I know Mark Chestnut.
No, Vic Chestnut passed away Christmas Day from an overdose of muscle relaxers. Brilliant. I mean, just brilliant songwriter. He was paralyzed in a car crash at the age of 18 and realized shortly thereafter that he could still play guitar and continued to play guitar and wrote these amazing songs and damned if he's not another victim of the American healthcare nightmare.
Wow, now it sounds like you're talking about Robert Wyatt from Soft Machine.
It's not that far different a story. You know, Vic Chestnut was one of these. What was one of the leading lights of Athens, Georgia, and you know what a music mecca that is.
Yeah.
And I mean, just look him up and listen to some of the songs; it'll blow you away.
Plus, you can actually get an education, I understand, at Athens. If you slow down the car and roll down the window, somebody will throw a diploma in your window.
Yeah, stop that. And then Mark Richt will pray with you.
And that, by the way, is the drag to go back to where you were talking about everything as a sports analogy. So you find an enlightened person that wants to talk to you in the South. And it's good, but if you're long-winded at all, they start looking at their watch and go, can you wrap this up? The Dogs are playing at 3.
That's true.
Or the horns or the Aggies. Of course, the Aggies didn't show up at 3 o'clock yesterday, did they?
Oh, that's it. Yeah, that's who Georgia beat.
Beat?
Womp.
Like a maroon-headed stepchild.
Yeah, I think even the A&M faithful sat down after a while with that one, from what I can tell.
Well, the worst thing was you looked at the total yards and they were just stomping them. It was special teams, that stat that didn't show up, kicked their ass. Listen to me, and I hate college. I mean, I love college football. I hate my school that I used to be such a big fan of. But like I said,
well, how do you think I feel? I mean, I spent time in Tuscaloosa. I went to school at the Capstone. And here I am rooting for Texas, just because it's so obscenely bass ackwards that they would pay this guy $4.5 million a year to run a football program.
Well, like I said, get ready when they start paying him 5.25 or 5.5 for actually.
Well, and that's the thing. If he wins a national championship, I think they will just have to name him Maximum Dictator of Alabama for life. But then again, if he wins a national championship, he might be induced to go somewhere else for $10 million a year.
Well, see, and that's the other thing. It's so weird that this Leach thing came up. And, of course, they already named, you know, freaking the Cincinnati coach, you know, new Pope up there in South Bend. But, you know, you had Leach put his ass out there, like, I don't know, 1 or 2 years ago when the big hiring jobs were going on because he wanted to leave Lubbock.
Yeah.
To which I go back to what I said earlier, you should visit it and you'll understand some of it, you know.
Oh, what, you know, I saw some pictures of the Texas, TCU campus at what, Waco?
Fort Worth.
Oh, they're in Fort, yeah, and it was just like, come to Holiday Inn University,
Hey, you know what, they got screwed, by the way, and that is another thing, I'm sorry, now I am back into the passion of the sports. They got screwed and Boise State got screwed.
Yes, they did.
They need a playoff.
And I was proud to hear Joe Paterno say the other day that he wanted a playoff.
Good for him. Yeah, and I'm betting, I'm wondering if Paterno really said, you know what, number one, first of all, I want that goddamn swoosh off my jersey, and I'd like a playoff, in parentheses. Yeah.
Well, no, what he really wants is a 12th team in the Big Ten. And it's so funny, every time all these people, and now it's
who
being...
Do you want?
Well, that's the funny part. He says, you know, I don't care who it is, you know, because you know how Paterno talks. I don't care who it is, you know, Syracuse, Rutgers, Pitt. Never says West Virginia, because the one thing he does not want is to ever
that's
be in...
too close, right? That's backyard shit, then.
Well, I mean, he's got a history. I mean, he just stomped the life out of us every... But, you know, he hates going to Morgantown because we're not at all nice to Penn State and never have been. But he wants that 12th team because you know that and he made, you know, he makes a good point. You know, we're out of it entirely. It's like listening to Peter Falk talk. Excuse me there. Just one more question, ma'am. We're out of the season. The season ends in the Big Ten entirely too early. We need one more game. You know, we don't have a championship game. We could have a championship game if we had 12 teams.
You just made me think of a great movie with Falk. And, I mean, I hate to reference anything as a great movie with Keanu Reeves in it. But did you ever see Tune In Tomorrow, where Falk was a radio guy?
No.
Oh.
My favorite Peter Falk film of all time and one of my favorite comedies of all time is The In-Laws, 1978.
Serpentine.
Serpentine, Sheldon. Serpentine.
Well, Bob, it's almost time to catch a bus. And by the way, that's another thing I'm thinking
that's
about.
That's bus, not buzz, right? Bus.
Oh, I'm working on the buzz. The bus, yeah, not a Z. Like I said, I have a cool boss. But no, as far as bus goes, and that goes back to that stupid thing I was talking about on the, on that thing with the East Side, tram or streetcar. Like I said, they rebranded it as streetcar, and, why did it jump back into that? Oh, because my bus rate, which they never improved or anything else, is about to get jacked another 30% for a monthly pass. Okay, I'm sure $28 is not too much a month to pay for transportation, you know. Except that it was 12 and then it was 18 and now they're going up to 28 and it's just like, you know, and you guys haven't added anything to it. Well, it's those same people, and part of it is they're trying to offset the cost of their stupid light rail that ain't running yet. And like I said, it's you know, and so if the first light rail ain't running, nobody's going to want a second one. So we'll call it a streetcar, and I'm going, wait a minute, it's got a track and big wheels, and it's huge, right? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, that's an effing train. Just for the record, you know. I mean, you know, but sorry, you suddenly hit me at a point where I got all worked up again, and. I suddenly sound like that lunatic idiot cousin I was talking about in Tejas. So, well, look, you guys have a great New Year's. And like I said, I love my Horn family so damn much, even though I don't know any of them, although I feel like I do, you know, so.
Understood.
I will let you guys go.
All right. Well, Lee, good talking to you, brother. And if we don't talk to you before the New Year, have a happy one.
All right. I'm going to go look for a star in the east or something, so.
Yeah, and three wise guys on your porch.
I think 3 years to get there as far as the wise men went, so.
Yeah, assuming they were real. And that's that's it. That's right there in Matthew. You know, when the wise men show up, he's living in a house.
Right. So are the three wise men really wise men, or did all of a sudden the belt of Orion show up at the house?
Well, there you go. Yeah, I know. Lee, take care.
Take care, sir.
Talk to you soon. Bye now. The I guess you could call Lee a football fan in spite of himself. And, yeah, just Peter, speaking of Peter Falk.
Jesus. I don't know what people are going to do when a six-pack of Budweiser costs $1,200.
Well, that'll be off.
You've got a collapse of confidence in the currency. People are going to panic.
Yeah.
There's going to be gold riots, atonal music, political chaos, right. Mass suicide, right?
Yeah.
It's Germany before Hitler. Uh-huh. You can see that.
Yeah.
If you have never seen The In-Laws, and don't watch the really, really yucky one with Michael Douglas and Albert Brooks. 1978, Alan Arkin, Peter Falk, Nancy Dessau, and a cast of absolute geniuses. It's worth your time. It'll make your stomach hurt. You'll laugh so hard. Wow, we managed to get through an hour and 10 minutes of the beginning of a Slow News Tuesday. And so far, it seems to be going fairly well. You're welcome to jump in with your thoughts, your observations, what have you. Any old way that you see fit, and we'll take it as it comes. There are other stories out there, of course. Some serious, some less so. Let's see. Piyush Jindal, because that is his real name. He's never really changed his name. There's no legal name change to Bobby Jindal. Piyush Jindal is working to make sure that his state sinks faster than it otherwise would. He's a climate change denier and is working actively to prevent climate change regulation from happening in poor, benighted Louisiana. Yeah, I know. That's out there, as well as a non-surprise and a surprise out of the Republican Party coming from Illinois. Sort of one of those round up the usual suspects moments. That's open for discussion. Maybe we'll get to that. The Irish religious sex scandal is sort of blossoming again. Truly disgusting. Quick email in from Critic at Large, Reverbo, noting Luke's conversation earlier about On the Waterfront, an email entitled Back to On the Waterfront. Directed by Elia Kazan, 1954, won 8 Oscars, nominated in 12 categories, including Best Picture, Best Actor for Brando, Best Supporting Actress for Eva Marie Saint. Lee J. Cobb's character was named Johnny Friendly, the corrupt union boss on the docks. Monikers don't get much more ironic than that. Rod Steiger plays Brando's brother, Charlie, who has Brando take the fall in the fight, resulting in one of the most powerful scenes in movie history, the I could have been a contender, Charlie. They spent just about $1 million on the Waterfront, but they forgot to pay for a rear projector, so in that famous scene in the cab, they had to use blinds in the rear window instead of running stock highway footage behind the actors. And Reverbo notes, and on and on, one of the greatest films. I may watch it myself this week. Happy New Year to all my friends at the Horn, from Reverbo, Critic at Large. And something that I know will speak to Reverbo. There's a bit of an anniversary coming along now. A blog post from In These Times by Gregory Sumner from back on December 23rd. He writes, Slaughterhouse-Five first appeared in bookstores 40 years ago. And the title of this, by the way, is Slaughterhouse-Five at 40. Why Vonnegut's classic novel transcends the 60s. I never knew there was a question of whether it did. Slaughterhouse-Five first appeared in bookstores 40 years ago, and it remains the signature achievement of Kurt Vonnegut's long and distinguished writing career. Long in gestation, it oscillates between realism and science fiction, mordant humor and grief, relieved by moments of unexpectedly lyrical imagery to convey the author's experience as a young soldier in the Second World War. He recounts for us his trials after capture by the Germans during their last great counteroffensive in the chaos of the Battle of the Bulge just before Christmas 1944. Through the tragicomic alter ego Billy Pilgrim, we learn about Vonnegut's 6 months as an object deprived of free will. We are with him standing in boxcars bound in mysterious stop-and-start fashion for unknown destinations. We encounter the baseness to which people can descend, as well as the nobility to which they sometimes rise in the most extreme situations. Then we find out what it is like to go through the apocalypse, the firebombing of the city of Dresden on the night of February 13, 1945, which Vonnegut and about 100 other Americans interned there miraculously survived. Then followed days and weeks when the prisoners were deployed in the process of corpse disposal. Imagine that task, that surreal landscape. When he got home, Vonnegut was shocked to find almost nothing about the raid and its ground-level consequences in newspaper archives, and came to the conclusion that his government, abetted by the press, could lie. The impulse to somehow tell his untellable war story, to expose it to the light, would drive him for decades, and it became the focus for his most ambitious work of art. Slaughterhouse-Five was an immediate critical and commercial sensation in 1969, and it has stood the test of time. It was named by the editorial board of the Modern Library, number 18 on the index of the most important English-language novels of the 20th century, and is now securely in the canon of assigned readings in high schools and colleges across the land. See, Gregory Sumner says, is now securely in the canon of assigned readings. I don't think there's any such thing as secure, because there's always some wingnut, always some bagger or birther or deather or tenther out there who wants to make sure that some particular book is removed from some high school's reading list because it might corrupt the children. We've seen that time after time after time. But anyway, the article continues. Says Mr. Sumner, like all of Vonnegut's published works, it has remained continually in print and available globally in multiple translations. It reached the big screen in 1972 in a film adaptation the author liked. Alternatively, it has been condemned and even burned by those claiming offense at its use of rough soldiers language, no doubt a disingenuous excuse to quash a message some consider dangerously unpatriotic. But given the book's almost corny faith in bygone civic virtue and the democratic traditions that lie at the heart of Vonnegut's vision, his identification with the insurrectionist 1960s generation is curious in some ways. Baby boomers formed the core of his underground cult audience before Slaughterhouse was published, and an accident of timing accounts for its deep footprint in the midst of the Vietnam trauma. Young people loved Vonnegut's bag of tricks, the demystification of the creative process, the fractured narrative, the time travel and flights to extragalactic planets like Tralfamador. They adopted to the point of cliché the fatalism of the novel's repeated phrase, "And so it goes." Along with fellow veteran Joseph Heller's 1961 landmark Catch-22, Slaughterhouse bookends the decade with an absurdist deglorification of the good war narrative. But just as a commentator for the Village Voice recently observed that Vonnegut has outlasted the counterculture that embraced him, Mr. Sumner says, I would argue that this most famous book transcends its immediate historical moment. It is really a meditation on the dignity, courage, and shattered dreams of the Great Depression generation. Its power and moral urgency come from sources far removed from the ideological wars of its time. It is important to consider Slaughterhouse-Five within the wider arc of Vonnegut's career, and to use another of its concepts to get it unstuck in time as something more than a 1960s relic. Beneath the structural gimmicks, the sardonic detachment, the childlike prose, all adroitly executed to be sure, lies a kind of humanism and even patriotism that is more enduring than some of its early readers might have suspected. The essay continues at length and is quite good. But like I said, perhaps because I wasn't old enough to participate in that 60s generation that protested the Vietnam War, when I came to Slaughterhouse Five, it didn't have that cachet for me. I heard the voice of someone who was of the same generation as my parents, echoing much of what my parents had said, although saying it with a pathos and a pain that they didn't show. And I never realized I was reading counterculture literature. Perhaps we would be better off if we quit baptizing things with names like that and let them stand on their own two legs. But, you know, who the heck am I? So that's, you know, just some stuff for the food for thought for the beginning of the for the first hour of the program. There's lots of stuff that we can have at, and we will. For now, we'll take a little break. On the way, Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen with the Green News Report, right here on America's Liberal Voice, right here on The Horn. Your calls are, of course, more than welcome. 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on. 304-658-3333. Jump right in. Conversation's fine.
Giants see themselves as bums. Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Tuesday, December 29, 2009.
Here we go again, another oil spill in Alaska. Mercury rising in Americans. Democrats get squishy on climate legislation. Plus, what really happened in Copenhagen?
What really did? All of that and more straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Prepare for 6 minutes of green news, politics, and snarky comments.
The Heritage Foundation says by 2035, the program will cost the average family $1,500 a year. But the EPA says $80 to $100 a year. But the American Petroleum Institute says $3,000 a year. But Sally Struthers says we can do it for just a dollar a day.
Keep that in mind, corporatist Democrats. This is your Green News Report. Report is brought to you by VelvetRevolution.us, now offering a $200,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of U.S. Chamber of Commerce CEO Tom Donahue for fraud and other crimes. Help VR push back against dozens of death threats, yes, death threats, that we've received from Fox News fans and Chamber members since our campaign began. Sign on to show your support for the good guys at StopTheChamber.com. That's StopTheChamber.com. Okay, Des, wrapping up a busy year, what do you have for us today?
Oh, here we go again. Yet another oil spill in Prince William Sound in Alaska on the very same reef as the infamous Exxon Valdez oil spill just over 20 years ago. On Christmas Day, a tugboat slammed into the very same reef, spilling diesel fuel into the once pristine waters of Alaska's Prince William Sound. But this time, thankfully, the oil slick was limited and nowhere near the 11 million gallons back in 89 that devastated one of the world's most prolific fisheries. The Anchorage Daily News reports residents as, quote, baffled as to how anyone could hit the most infamous rock in Prince William Sound.
Yeah, no kidding. Everyone knows about this reef. Any explanation yet for the cause of this?
No, it's under investigation, but both the captain and the crew have been cleared of any alcohol or drugs.
Well, we'll find out in maybe 10 or 20 years that Exxon won't have to pay much for any of this, just as occurred with the Exxon Valdez after the Supreme Court took their billions-dollar settlement and cut it down to just about nothing, making it well worth running into that reef.
Mercury emissions are rising in the center of the country. The Chicago Tribune examined new federal data on emissions and reports that the data shows the amount of mercury emissions dumped into the air from coal-fired power plants in Illinois jumped 7% last year. Michigan and Texas saw even larger gains in mercury pollution. The Tribune says the increase is due in part to the particular type of coal and the lack of smokestack emissions controls at plants in those states. But over the same period, emissions actually dropped overall nationwide. Nearly half the nation's freshwater fish are contaminated with mercury, a potent neurotoxin that exceeds federal levels for safe consumption. There are still no national standards for mercury pollution, although the Obama administration is in the process of changing that.
I'm getting real tired of saying we could send a man to the moon in about 9 years, but we can't figure out how to cut carbon emissions from the use of coal in this country on this planet. But don't get me started.
Speaking of toxic mercury contamination, the Centers of Disease Control for the first time is tracking widespread mercury exposure in Americans. The results of the CDC study announced earlier this month show that Americans are showing increasing levels of mercury in their blood. It's part of a wider effort by the CDC to track the wide range of chemicals now found in Americans from industrial activity and agricultural pollution. The study also found for the first time perchlorate was found in every subject. Perchlorate is the rocket fuel additive made famous in the film Aaron Brockovich Markovich, and it confirms that over 90% of Americans now have BPA in their blood, a synthetic estrogen chemical used in plastics.
I'm thinking of turning myself into a plastic water bottle.
There is some good news from the study. It does confirm that lead exposure in children has continued to decrease since the 1970s. More details are emerging from the high-level talks on the last day of the Copenhagen Climate Summit. The contentious negotiations at the United Nations Climate Summit ended without a legally binding agreement to cut global emissions. Accusations have been flying ever since, with many environmental activists blaming President Obama for lack of leadership at the negotiations. But Mark Linus, a journalist who attended the summit as an aide to the president of the island nation of the Maldives, has a different perspective. He was in the room during that meeting and has written a first-person account that places the blame for obstruction on China. He believes China's tactics successfully prevented any truly binding agreement and made it appear that Obama was the one who failed on the world stage. It's a fascinating account in The Guardian. We have the links at greennews.bradblog.com. Finally, although the health insurance reform fight isn't nearly over, conservative Senate Democrats are now telling the White House to drop any idea of climate and clean energy legislation in the Senate this year because it's too controversial. The cap-and-trade bill already passed the House in June, but the Senate version has been stalled during the bruising fight over health care insurance reform. Proponents of the legislation note that the cap-and-trade policy has considerable selling points, including creating new jobs in a growing renewable energy sector, and the fact that the Congressional Budget Office says the Senate bill will actually reduce the federal budget deficit. They also note that polls consistently show a majority of Americans want the federal government to regulate emissions, but that's not good enough for conservative Senate Democrats. Senator Mary Landrieu of Louisiana tells Politico she's been trying to get the White House to put off the legislation until 2011.
Yeah, let's get it straight. Those aren't conservative Democrats. Those are corporatist Democrats. Read about that and much more at our website, and stay tuned later this week for a roundup of the most important green news stories of the year and even the decade. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Yeah, what's 30 minutes among friends? So it's the second half of the program. Yeah, we can live with that, right? Sure, why not? It is about 26 minutes before the hour. And if you've got something, some burr under your saddle, some bee in your bonnet, by all means, don't let it sit there and just buzz around. Those things can sting. Fire up the phone. In the meantime, however, I wanted to share something with you, a little story that I ran across that, well, it had some resonance for me, simply because of where we are. It was, I was sitting here in the studio yesterday, we heard one of those massive bomb blast noises that means that they're blowing up a mountain around here somewhere, and it can't mean any good for any of us. It's dangerous to be a native to a region where the powers that be, more clearly defined as the monies that be, decide they want what you have. I told you the story, I guess, last week of what happened when our good friend Judy Bonds went into magistrate court in Raleigh County to prosecute the attack that was launched against her by a
by a pro-Massey supporter back last June. The woman crossed the line, deliberately went up to Judy and hit her in the head. It was uncontrovertible. She was guilty, 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 guilty. And, of course, at the trial in magistrate court, the magistrate saw the footage, heard the evidence, and pronounced guilt upon Ruth Tucker, and then said, well, your punishment is a $100 fine for committing a battery, a $100 fine, court costs, and go and sin no more. Like I said, they're a violent lot. But there's violence and there's violence. If you live somewhere where someone wants what you have or what you happen to be sitting on top of, and it got, yeah, this will be the second night with a reference to Avatar in it, it can be really dodgy. In particular, we're talking about the story of Dora Alicia Sorto Recinos, 32 years old, El Salvadoran. 3:30 yesterday afternoon, or 3:30 Sunday afternoon, I suppose. No, Saturday afternoon. She was on her way home. Well, she was 8 months pregnant. And on her way home from doing laundry in a nearby river, her son was walking with her, when armed men set upon her and gunned her down, murdered her in her tracks. What was her crime? What was Dora Alicia Sorto Recinos' crime? Her crime was being a farmer. And a member of the Environmental Committee of Cabañas, which is a department in El Salvador. That group opposes a planned gold mine. Sweet Jesus. Yeah, because there's just not enough gold on the market. A planned gold mine as projected by a company called Pacific Rim of Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. She is dead, Dora Alicia Sorto Recinos. Her husband, 2 years before, got two fingers chopped off for opposing that same gold mine. And her murder was not a novelty. Her murder was the second this week, or the second in the past week, of someone who is opposed to Pacific Rim's desire to drag gold out of the earth in Cabañas Directorate of El Salvador. On December the 20th, and despite 24-hour police protection, another activist by the name of Ramiro Rivera Gomez was gunned down for opposing Pacific Rim. Both from the small community named Trinidad in Cabañas Department. And by the way, these thugs also shot Dora Sorto Recinos' son. Shot him in the foot. Now, bear in mind, the community opposes this nightmarish. And I mean, we know what an environmental and human rights hell mountaintop removal is. Gold mining is too. Gold mining is toxic past toxic. We're not talking about a situation where someone goes in and digs out nuggets and brings them out. No. We're talking about the literal leaching of mineral or precious metal bearing, ore bearing soil that renders the entire area unfit for human habitation for generations, if not forever. And the community didn't want the mine. And here's a new one. Neither did the Salvadoran government. The Salvadoran government refused to issue the permits necessary for this gold leaching operation to go forward. How's that? Well, why then would it happen? Pay attention. This is important. Alicia Sorto Recinos was murdered in the name of gold. Ramiro Rivera gunned down in the sight of his daughter in the name of gold. His neighbor, Felicita Echevarria, also killed in that attack. And this past June, Marcelo Rivera, who was no relation to Ramiro, was tortured and killed in the name of gold. Now, how is it that there is even any further thought that this mining activity would take place when both the people and the government are opposed to it? You're going to love this. No, you're not. And that's smart-assedness on my part that is untoward and improper. Community organizers blocked Pacific Rim's attempts to get gold mining permits. And Pacific Rim, a corporation, then lawyered up, as William the Bloody Crystal might say, and filed a lawsuit against the very government of El Salvador itself. What, then, what standing would they have to sue? Well, they had in their hands this corporation, this non-governmental entity representative of no one but their avaricious shareholders, their CEOs and their board of directors. They had in hand a little something-something called the U.S. Central America Free Trade Agreement. And it was under CAFTA that they filed this lawsuit against the Salvadoran government. Here's the punchline. Despite the fact that there is the common thread of opposition to this gold mine running through all of these murders, local police authorities and the former Attorney General's Office of El Salvador have classified each of these executions as, quote-unquote, common crimes. The report that I'm looking at now, which comes from the Media Co-op, says, Salvadorans are fearful and outraged by the continued violence and by the inability or unwillingness of the police and the Office of the Attorney General to protect community activists like Alicia Sorto Recinos, Ramiro Rivera, and Marcelo Rivera. Community members believe that until these cases are thoroughly investigated for political motives and the perpetrators brought to justice, impunity against mining resistance in Cabañas will continue. And as it says, sending a message to the intellectual authors of these crimes that they can continue their wave of violence and murders without punishment. Do you ever look at the things in your world and wonder how they touch other people? Anybody get a gold necklace for a girlfriend, mother, daughter, sister? Anybody buy a watch bearing gold or a gold-plated this or a gold-plated that for some man in your or boy in your world this past Christmas? Just as is the case with diamonds, so too gold is soaked in blood. When a disgusting right-wing gas bag like Glenn Beck says gold is your best hedge against inflation, what he's really saying is that human blood is your best hedge against inflation. Things don't just happen, I suppose, is what I'm arguing. I suppose what I'm arguing is that there nothing in our world anymore is prosaic. We are so interconnected that we touch the horrors that touch other people, and we can't help it. Just as you can go to ilovemountains.org and type in your zip code and see exactly what your local connection is to mountaintop removal and to what's happening to people in Appalachia, so too, probably within eyesight or arm's reach, including perhaps in the computer on which you are listening to this program, there is some gold. And the need for that gold drives the end of 8 months pregnant 32-year-old mothers returning from doing laundry at a stream at Streamside in a department of northern El Salvador. And I honestly don't know what the answer is. I don't think, I mean, by referencing the computer, for instance, there are things that we can't get along without. But I don't think that that's the essence of the problem. It's not what we have so much that's the problem, but what we waste that is the problem. And what we want more of. It would be interesting to do a little bit more research on Pacific Rim. Because I remember another Canadian firm some years back, what was the name of it? Barrick Goldstrike Limited? Didn't they bury some union organizers alive in Africa? Wasn't that them? Perhaps I'm wrong. But inevitably, where something is deemed precious, there will be people on top of that which is deemed precious who are deemed expendable in the name of that which is precious. And the question becomes one of how do we rearrange our priorities in such a way as to put some level of existential distance and, in fact, put some level of conscience into the process. Because I'm totally creeped out right now. We work on justice issues here in the hills. And others work much harder than I. And we try to be aware of the struggles that others have for some modicum of justice in their own world. And just as their electricity may come from coal, so too there may be something in our home that contributes to their misery. And how, therefore, how do you address that?
Hey, boss.
Hey, what's up, Gene?
Funny you should mention Barry Gold. Hold on. Let me put you back in the speaker. I hope you don't mind.
Not at all. Do I still have you, Gene?
Yeah, you do. Sorry, I keep doing this. That story you just referenced, it's what do you think?
Take a breath. It's okay.
Yeah. We're at Pete Gold. We didn't have to do anything. It cost the company. More to figure out now than it used to or it will. So, it's no sense. It makes no sense at all. Because all they have to do is sit on that gold and the prices would go up anyway. We're at peak. Or we're past peak.
Past. I mean, you think about, and this is just the weird way my mind works, Gene. When I see, for instance, that, when you think of all the gold items in museums that are products of the artistry of antiquity, whether it be ancient works of gold art from Mesoamerican empires or from the Egyptians or Babylonians or what have you, well, that stuff's sitting in museums.
Yeah.
But for everything that was in a museum, somebody somewhere along the way has melted more down.
Yeah.
And I always think of the image of the Spanish conquistadores being brought these precious works of art and building fires on the beaches, on the beachheads of Mesoamerica and Peru, and melting all this precious art down and turning it into dull, boring slabs, ingots of gold that they then loaded aboard ship and sent back to Spain. Wait. And you wonder, whatever happened to it all? Where'd it go?
I don't know, but you can't have them sending back heathen devil worship and idols and junk like that.
No, right.
It's funny because this whole mess, I mean, it's a slight on so many levels of the way people want to live. And it kills me to hear crap like this, especially when we're past peak. It's not like they're not going to make any money. I mean, after all, I mean, this is it's ridiculous. I was going to actually call in and complain because about my personal situation here in the sense of it was 50 degrees yesterday and it, now we've got snow and I had to drive home in it. But this is a little more important, so I'll let somebody else on here. But that makes me so mad. So
if it is indeed scarce, Gene, that's the thing. If it is necessary for certain applications like, sensitive electronic equipment or life-saving medical gizmos and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
then might the prudent thing be to stop wasting it as ornamentation?
Well,
I mean, do we have enough to do both? If we're killing 8 months pregnant 32-year-old women in El Salvador, I would submit that no, we don't have enough to do both.
Well, I mean, geez, or you could at least go back to and look at the tailings and see what you could get with that. I mean, this is one of those intractable problems. It's this. I wonder sometimes, Bob, how you can be so, I envy you in the sense of, I mean, I couldn't approach this in a non-violent manner. I would be, oh,
But Gene, when you realize what violence gets, you realize that, you know, how can I put this? Nonviolence is not a choice. Nonviolence is the only way there is. Because they can outviolence us a million to one.
Yeah, I guess they can.
And would like nothing better than if we were violent. So we have to be nonviolent. Because, among other things, we'd like for there to be a world left worth fighting, struggling for. I try to avoid that war analogy, or fighting, or any of that stuff. No, it's a struggle.
Yeah.
And there's no implied violence in struggle.
Well, yeah, I know technically you're right. I just struggle with getting to the point where it's almost as bad as war, but.
No, that's what they've got coming toward us. It's the fact of the matter is, we have to not do what that we have to not be. You cannot fight evil with evil. I guess is what I'm arguing.
I know, but I guess I sometimes I wonder. I mean, is it evil? I don't know. I get so cynical anymore at the things that go on. I mean, I've even gotten to the point where I think, well, if we save this, then how do we know things won't get so bad that the people at the other side, whoever's left on there, says, oh, that's mine, thanks for saving it for me, you know?
Sure.
And I'm sorry, I don't mean to be so down. This makes me crazy. But we all know that, and I'll let somebody on that's much more positive than I am.
Don't sell yourself short, Gene. It's good talking to you, brother.
Yeah. Good talking to you. Things have got to change. They've just got to change.
Well, all we have to do is keep working, and they will.
Okay.
Well, all right. Take care, Gene.
Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Bye now. News Ninja Gene calling from Oregon, and we roll along. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Hey, Sandra.
Hey, I just couldn't resist because that story, I know about that story. And you know what? You know, Weber said that the state had the monopoly on the use of force, the state. But I see we've elevated to just the corporation now has that definition because they are now using Kafka is I forget the name of the resolution, but it allows these corporations to sue countries, which is what you mentioned. That's what they're doing. They're using Chapter 10. It's Chapter 11 in NAFTA, and in Kafka it's Chapter 10.
Well, the thing that kind of throws me, though, Sandra, is it's the U.S. Central American Free Trade Agreement,
and
this is a Vancouver, British Columbia outfit.
Right, but they have a subsidiary in Nevada. Hello.
Son of a...
Okay, don't get it straight. They got a subsidiary in Nevada. Okay?
They got a post office box in Nevada.
Whatever, but that is this is what they've done. They've so it's allowing them to utilize that Chapter 10, which essentially gives, you know, the corporate governance over sovereign nations because El Salvador could pay $77 million, which is what the corporation is suing them for. Now, you're telling me that a sovereign nation has to now cough up $77 million to keep some goddamn corporation from using cyanide to destroy their environment. You understand what I'm saying?
I do.
It's beyond the beyond, and the fact that basic people don't understand what's going on is...
Well, how far different from this is this from the British opium wars against China?
Exactly. I mean, all the treaties, I put that in quotes, that was forced on the Chinese, that's what that was. Same deal. You're exactly right. It's a good analogy because these agreements, you know, you're like, okay, I'm thinking, let me see, sovereign, Westphalia, nation state. Now, that's what I thought we was operating under, Bob. But we ain't. Obviously not.
No.
Because, and what's even more striking is, after I explained all that, they have all that power, yet and still they still got to gun down folks. On top of all that, that's what's killing me. I'm like, wait a minute. Okay, obviously, whatever that woman was working on was goddamn effective. And God bless her and rest her soul. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I hope somebody takes care of her little boy.
Well, I'm just saying, though, it just speaks volumes that.
Well, but you know, there is another side to this coin, though, Sandra, and that is this: if corporations can behave as sovereign states, then can they not be warred upon as such as well?
Well, exactly. No, I mean that's the thing. It's like El Salvador. You know, I don't know what action they can take. They can expropriate the mine. You see what I'm saying? They can take. There are still tools that sovereign states can use. You see, and El Salvador is another one of those Latin countries that sort of gone left the center. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
For the first time, like ever, and even the government is trying to preserve. All they're trying to do is preserve their environment. This is the thing that kills me. It's like, you know what? How much is enough up in this? What in the world? You know, the gold prices are going so high that now that people have lost their minds, they got to start gunning down pregnant women?
I know.
I mean, I'm not. And I don't
well, know. I mean, and let's assume for a moment that maybe El Salvador is acting with a certain degree of enlightenment and merely sitting on the reserves until they gain in value.
Well, no, if you need cyanide, you see what I'm saying? There's all sorts of ways of extracting. They don't want to adhere to environmental impact. That's what happened. The El Salvador government did a study. They said, oh, no, this is going to cause X damage to our environment, so no, you cannot get the permit.
Right, because they've got places like Montana.
Should be end of story, right? But it's not. The corporation says no. And they, you know, do what I just told you they're doing. And they're demanding the government to pay. So you got to pay to, you know, some foreign transnational to protect your people. I mean, it is like invading armies, you know?
But it very much is. And this is, you know, I had a cup of coffee in law school once upon a time. And this just runs contrary to every last shred of anything that I was ever taught.
No, it's stunning, and it's stunning that, you know, in the back of my mind, I keep thinking about Honduras. I'm like, all that is just playing over. It's like, you know, these are demons. They're vultures, what's going on. It's like, no, there is no stopping. It's like sort of, oh, wait a minute, Latin America is going a bit left. I.e. trying to serve the people. Let's just say what it is. They had the Chicago boys there. They went through that spasm. They got rid of them people. The neoliberal thing isn't working for them. Brazil, I think, was the only country that didn't take derivatives on. And looky-see, their economy's doing pretty well. You hear what I'm saying?
Yeah, they're actually ahead of the game in some regards.
And that's because they said no to the WTO financial agreement that's been sort of forced down everyone's throat, which is why we have these derivatives.
Right. Well, and consider, you know, it was a couple of years ago that Greg Palast was writing about Ecuador and their gas reserves.
Yeah.
And the IMF was, you know, leaning on them hard. I mean, the behavior of these organizations is far more reminiscent of mob activity than it is anything regarding government, you know, governments established among humankind for human benefit. You know, you come in, well, you know, we got to have all your gas reserves or else we're going to call the note.
No, but it's really interesting. If you look at the exceptions, like Malaysia was an exception during the Asian financial crisis in the late 90s, and look, you see, they survived. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Brazil didn't accept derivatives, and look where they are. I mean, you know what? It's like, what the hell? the U.S. is quite happy to let its country go down the drain because of ideology, the neoliberal thing. It's right in your face. It's not working yet, and still, we still are applying it to us now. It's like cannibalizing ourselves. I've never seen anything like it. I'm stunned that that story you just talked about, yeah, I've been following that, and it's horrific because they have to get that gold.
And there's my, for what?
Right. No.
I mean, have I just lost all perspective by asking a question like that, Sandra?
No.
For what?
And at this point, because it is a theater of the absurd, when this woman and her unborn child has to be sacrificed. There is no reason. Really. Is there a line? Can there be a line drawn for this? I don't know if it's greed. It's not even rational. It's outrageous.
And that's where my mind goes. Who's the CEO of this outfit, Pacific Rim? And what is his day like? And when he finds out that a 32-year-old woman who's 8 months pregnant has been gunned down for opposing his unwanted mine in El Salvador, what does he do? Does he pick up the phone and who does he call first, the lawyers or the PR department, Sandra?
Well, no, exactly, and it's just. It's mind-numbing what's happening. They're going to kill off the leadership in the hopes that what? The people will just roll over? I highly doubt it because they're fighting for their environment where they have to live and farm.
Well, I mean, and whether it's, whether it's the unmanned predator drone attacks on Afghan weddings, or hired gun thugs blowing away pregnant 32-year-olds, doesn't the sum total and effect of the outcome of that create more problem than less? I mean, isn't that a recruiting poster for the? I mean, doesn't that prove that Pacific Rim has no business there?
Yeah, but we had please, the United Food Corporation. I mean, they've had more of what this is than not, though. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and so they're having a look see now on maybe not having it, and my God, the weight of whatever is coming down on that. It's not just El Salvador. I mean, it's horrible to watch.
I mean, I'm looking at their website right now.
Oh, you went that far. Wow.
Yeah, I can forget about the Subway sandwich at the end of this show. And lo and behold, their website, for the love of God, their website, Sandra, has a little map of Central America with a big red circle around El Salvador.
Wow, okay. I didn't know what to say about that.
I mean, is anybody paying attention? Let's see. Pacific Rim is an environmentally and socially responsible exploration company focused exclusively on high-grade, environmentally clean gold deposits in the Americas. Pacific Rim's primary asset and focus of its growth strategy is the high-grade, vein-hosted El Dorado gold. Jesus Christ, it's the 21st century, and some rotten white bastard is still looking for El Dorado. I mean, honestly, El Dorado Gold Project in El Salvador. The company owns several similar grassroots... What the... grassroots gold projects?
And that's on their website today, this out.
Right now, as I speak to you.
And we had just heard reports of two or three in the last week, right?
Three murders, because the neighbor got whacked, too. On the one on December 20th.
And they'll just press on with whatever pressure they're putting on the government there. Because, once again, I heard that report on Democracy Now. I don't know where you got it from.
I picked it up at Truth Out via Democracy Now and then just drilled down a little further.
Well, anyway, I gotta go.
I know. Honest to God, it just beats the pants off of me, Sandra. It does.
Yes, too much. Anyway, have a nice New Year.
You too. Enjoy the ball games.
Thank Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Let's read that again. Because I don't know, if we say it three times, George Orwell may appear in my studio. You know, kind of like saying Beetlejuice three times. Pacific Rim Mining. Pacific Rim is an environmentally and socially responsible exploration company focused exclusively on high-grade, environmentally clean gold deposits in the Americas. And, of course, they've got lovely photographs across the top of their website that show happy people, happy men in shirts with ripped-off sleeves doing something with I don't know what, and another guy walking in a trench in a jungle, and then there's another photograph of this beautiful, verdant valley scene that once they're done with it, won't look anything like that. Pacific Rim's primary asset and focus of its growth strategy is the high-grade, vein-hosted El Dorado Gold Project in El Salvador. The company owns several similar grassroots gold projects in El Salvador. Listen, this crap has been going on since roughly 1492. And they don't understand why maybe the natives are finally a little bit tired of it. And even the government, in an attempt to be responsible and responsive to its people, says, nah, we don't think we want you. And yet they get to sue a sovereign state, as Sandra pointed out, under a noxious piece of legislation that was ramrodded through a do-nothing, complacent Congress? Astonishing. This website was last updated on Friday, December 11th, 2009. Yeah, because December 26th and December 20th were kind of not such good reports. Oh, look, projects about El Salvador. Coming soon. Okay. El Dorado, El Salvador. Advanced stage exploration project with resources of 1.4 million gold equivalent ounces and abundant blue sky potential for additional resource discovery. What in the name of God does that mean, blue sky potential? Arbitration claim under CAFTA in process while environmental and mining permits being sought. Oh, here's the fun part. The El Dorado project is 100% owned by Pacific Rim through its wholly owned subsidiaries, Pac Rim Cayman LLC, a Nevada corporation, see, Sandra was right, and its Salvadoran enterprises Pacific Rim El Salvador S.A. de C.V. and Dorado Exploraciones S.A. de C.V. inclusive. It's a 144-square-kilometer area covered by three exploration licenses with nominal expiry dates of September 28, 2013 and September 29, 2013, and a 12.75-square-kilometer area pending conversion to an exploitation concession. I used to think I spoke English. And regardless of all of this gobbledygook, three human beings are getting comfortable in their graves. For what? For what? I think I better take a little break and get away from this story
before I scream myself hoarse. Give the gift of gold. Did you catch those little commercials over the Christmas season? Or any day on Fox? Gold, it's your friend. And that story of, what was her name? The wife of one of the Henry Kings of France who turns out died because she ate too much gold, alimentary gold or nutritional gold or what. She's a gold eater. The literal appetite for gold among the conquistadores and their progeny never ceases to amaze. And if you happen to be Anglo, don't be feeling all righteous because your forebears weren't down there wiping out the noblest culture on the planet in the 16th century. England came to North America looking for gold. They just looked in all the wrong places and didn't find anyone. Didn't stop them trying, though. No. So we'll take a little break and come back. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. Light up the phones. We've got a little time left. This is The Horn.
I would give the world to see how I used to be when I had no axe to grind except for chopping wood. Day was day and night was night, wrong was never right. Didn't matter where I went as much as where I stood. I had dreams average size. There were stars in the sky. Not my eyes. Then I got gold fever. No romp and rollin' girl and fellow stuff can cure the gold fever. Nothing can help you but the yellow stuff. What can stop that itching? Ain't around the kitchen, gold, gold, hook am I. Susanna, go ahead and cry. Once we all did honest work, farmer, lawyer, clerk, married men and single men and some who ain't too sure. Now I look at them and see duplicates of me, cured of what we suffered from and suffering from the cure. Who can say why we came? Where's the hope? Where's the flame? We're the same. When you've got gold fever, no romp and rollin' girl and fella stuff can cure the gold fever. Nothing can help you but the yellow stuff. What can stop that itching around the kitchen? Gold, gold.
All terribly heroic, isn't it? It really is. It's just terribly, terribly heroic. I remember reading somewhere that some native once upon a time said that the white man suffers from a disease of the heart that can only be cured by gold. But we'll step away from that because there's other stuff. Show of hands, please. It's a liberal audience. Show of hands. This is the romper room portion of the program. I can see the hands that are up. Who here has ever bought soy milk? Okay. Thinking that maybe you were giving the poor cattle a break or something like that. And odds are, if you did, you bought a brand of soy milk called Silk. Well, guess what? You've been hoodooed. Of course. And you're surprised. This is from naturalnews.com, by the way. Mike Adams is the health ranger editor of naturalnews.com. And he writes, until early 2009, Silk brand soy milk was made using organic soybeans. But earlier this year, Dean Foods Corp. Inc. LLC, God knows what, Dean Foods, owner of the Silk brand, quietly switched to conventional soybeans, which are often grown with pesticides. And he also doesn't note, and are often genetically modified soybeans, but never mind. But they kept, here's the fun part, they kept the same UPC barcodes on the products. And as Mike Adams notes, they also kept the product label virtually the same, merely replacing the word organic with natural in a way that was barely noticeable. The price also remained the same, so that people purchasing Silk soy milk, I will not use that hateful POS word, consumer, people who purchased soy milk at organic prices were buying something that was cheaper to produce, so, hey, look, everybody, more profit. Mr. Adams notes many retailers and consumers never noticed the bait and switch, so they kept buying Silk, thinking it was still organic. You know, you feel so much better when you go to Starbucks and you order your soy milk latte, chai, mocha, macchiato, grande, espresso, whatnot. Because, you know, it's soy. It's good for us. But Adams notes many retailers and consumers never noticed the bait-and-switch tactic, so they kept buying Silk, thinking it was still organic. The shift on the product label from organic to natural wasn't well understood by consumers either. Many consumers continue to think that the term natural is basically the same as organic, when in fact they are almost opposites. The term natural is entirely unregulated, and almost anything can be claimed to be natural, even when it's sprayed with pesticides or treated with other chemicals. Case in point, I'm an ice cream freak. You know, that's that whole Northern European thing going on for me. I ought to be avoiding it, but I'm addicted to fat. I am butter, you know, bacon grease. Oh, God. Yeah, but a classic, I love ice cream. Oh, I love ice cream. And it used to be that I would only buy Breyers. Because Breyers vanilla and Breyers chocolate had a list of ingredients that was about five things long and never included the words carrageenan, guar gum, or locust bean gum, because as much as I love ice cream, I just can't imagine enjoying guar gum. I don't even like saying guar gum or carrageenan. And yes, I know, there's stabilizers or modifiers, and they keep the ice cream from going grainy. BS. When it comes into our house, it ain't going to go grainy because won't be there long enough. Because it's ice cream, and I have passed the gene on into the next generation. God, it's like watching buzzards when I bring it in here. But anyway, so I'm in the store the other day, and I pick up the ice cream carton, and there in big, bold words on the Breyers carton, all natural. No. I've been down the food midway. I've been to the food carnival. I read every damned label, just about. Except for the tomato soup label that Richard read to me last week. The high fructose corn soup. And there it is. On the front, Breyers, all natural. On the side, Guar gum. Carrageenan, locust bean gum. And we, you know, whatever, free market? Free market? Really? The market's free? As a participant in the free market, I can't seem to get away from that crap. Okay, well, there went the Breyers. Let me pick up the blue bunny. Nope. Guar gum. All right, well, we'll try the turkey. Guar gum. Well, Jesus, at least the Ben and Jerry's carrageenan. Okay, the old standby, Häagen-Dazs. Derp. Except Häagen-Dazs has come out with a little brand of pints that are priced daily, just like gold, on some market somewhere, called Five. And I think they've got coffee, flavor, vanilla, brown sugar, and something else. But there's five ingredients. It's kind of like an ice cream Rennheitsgebot. And maybe this just marks me as overly prissy about things, but I don't think so. Until somebody can convince me that what's her name, who invented the first ice cream churn back in the early 19th century or whatever, had a little pouch of carrageenan or locust bean gum or guar gum that she was adding. No! Because, you know, I've turned the crank a few times on a hot summer's afternoon and cheated occasionally and just plugged the little bastard in. And it was milk, and it was sugar, and it was vanilla, or a scraped out vanilla bean if we were being highfalutin back in the day when we could afford vanilla beans. Not just a whole lot goes into ice cream. And never locust bean gum. Or guar gum. Or carrageenan. And bless his heart, if our good friend, the internet's most brilliant satirist, Eugene Finnerman, is listening or catches this on a podcast, he's going to run to his beloved Edie's and go, oh! Because it's there, too. And the more stuff you like in your ice cream, the weirder it gets. Because, God forbid, there's some Reese's peanut butter cups chunked into it. Because then you get the ingredient label for that. And it's all, put it down, sister. Put it down. So, anyway, be alert. Natural just about guarantees you that there's some sort of unnatural something. Well, you know, it grows in the ground. That's natural, isn't it? Mr. Adams continues, this bait-and-switch ploy continued throughout 2009 until a few watchdog organizations, bless them, started to catch on to the covert switch. In late October, the Cornucopia Institute accused Target stores of misleading consumers by advertising silk products using the old organic labeling, even though the product being sold in stores was not organic. And then they targeted Dean Foods for blurring the line between organic and natural. Then a sunflower health food store in Texas also found itself caught up in the bait and switch. It had been reordering silk for months, thinking that the product was still organic. But then they discovered the scam and put up a handwritten sign in front of the silk products warning consumers with this message, silk is no longer organic. Bless their hearts. Store owner said, we do not want to be part of a customer deception. and food retailers in California, Delaware, and Texas duped by Silk? Because Dean Foods never, ever bothered to tell retailers that they'd switched from organic to pesticide soybeans. Consumer Reports has gotten on the bandwagon, saying Dean has only added to the marketplace confusion between natural and organic, as they definitely do not mean the same thing, and natural requires no verification whatsoever. Now, what do these two things have together? You know, the soy milk versus gold? Well, the reason that Dean went to pesticide soybeans is because somebody from Monsanto or whatever went to Dean and said, you know, listen, we're growing some great genetically modified soy over here, and, you know, your customers won't know if notice if there's a little soy running through their system with a goat gene spliced into it. What the hell? What'll they know? Bunch of dummies? And Dean said, you think we could charge more for you? What? Charge more? Don't charge more. Charge the same. Pay less. More profit. Easy. Oh, wow. What's the common thread? The corporate drive. The inexorable urge to drag just a little bit more out of you and me. Soy milk? What do you got to do to a soybean to get soy milk? Is that like the front end of tofu? I honestly don't know. I mean, I've learned to like a tofu and some stuff. But the fact of the matter is, that stuff's dangerous if you're eating the stuff that's produced with from the GM crops with all the pesticides and stuff. The soy that became such a mainstay and a staple of the Asian diet wasn't grown that way. But we got it over here, and we corporatized it. And that means we poisoned it, and pesticided it, and herbicided it, and genetically modified it with, I don't know, worm spleen genes, or, you know. I mean, to be fair, it's the Frankenspud, the Monsanto Frankenspud that has the goat stomach gene spliced into it. I don't know what the genetically modified soy is. I don't want to, and I don't want to consume it. Jude notes, gold and Glenn Beck, it's all running together, Bob. I viewed Glenn Beck sitting in some office with a window a few weeks back. It appeared he was being a broker for gold to encourage his viewers to buy gold. I wonder how many Fox News viewers have bought into all of this. And, you know, that's the whole idea. They're not viewers, they're consumers. They are rubes. If someone you know is a dedicated viewer of Fox News, then understand absolutely all the way down to the ground, they're not customers, they're not viewers, they're not valued participants in the process. They are stooges. They are fools. They are manipulable, willfully willing idiots to be hustled by the likes of Glenn Beck. They are put there. God puts everything on this planet for a purpose, and some people was put here to serve as a profit generator for Rupert Murdoch. See how it works? Now, I mentioned earlier Piyush Jindal. The closer we get, the more I'm convinced that this guy will be, unless we can catch him with either a dead girl or a live boy, he'll be somebody's vice presidential nominee come 2012. Probably either Jeb Bush's or Tim Pawlenty's. The folks over at Think Progress are reporting, even as the Senate argues whether to pass clean energy legislation, the Environmental Protection Agency is finally moving to regulate global warming pollution. One of the leading opponents to the EPA's proposed regulations, slated to go into effect in March 2010, is, of course, and see, come on, Think Progress, come on, guys. Dude's name is not Bobby Jindal. You can search high and low through the courthouse records of every blessed parish in Louisiana, and you will never find an official court petition changing Piyush Jindal's name to Bobby. It's just his name. It's not negative. It's what's negative is allowing him to use a Brady Bunch name as his own and perpetuate an ongoing fraud. So even to the Think Progress guys, I say, you know, come on. His name's Piyush. Anyway, they say one of the leading opponents to the EPA's proposed regulations slated to go into effect in March 2010 is Louisiana Governor Piyush Jindal. On Monday, Jindal and the secretaries of the Louisiana Department of Natural Resources and Louisiana Economic Development filed objections with EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson. They said that the Supreme Court mandated standards, quote, will certainly have profound negative economic impacts. This is the quote. There is no doubt this change will certainly have profound negative economic impacts on the state of Louisiana as well as the entire country. Well, that last clause is superfluous because they have no standing to bitch about what happens in the rest of the country. But in either instance, they are, what's the word we're looking for here? Oh, yes, lying. Because, as Think Progress notes, in reality, regulations to limit greenhouse gases would actually reward business investment in labor instead of pollution, in new technology and development instead of reliance on 19th-century fuel sources. An analysis by the Center for American Progress and the Political Economy Research Institute found that strong regulation and standards would create billions in revenue and tens of thousands of new jobs. From that report, Louisiana could see a net increase of about $2.2 billion in investment revenue and 29,000 jobs based on its share of a total of $150 billion in clean energy investments annually, every year, annually, across the country. This is even after assuming a reduction in fossil fuel spending equivalent to the increase in clean energy investments. Wow. So Piyush Jindal wants to fight against regulation of climate crisis-inducing pollutions and pollutants. And yet it's those same pollutants that are causing his state to sink. Sink. You know, beneath the waves, Maldives sink. And what was the estimate for the average on in the Maldives? There's no point higher or something like that than 4 meters above sea level. It ain't much better in the bayou areas and the lower lying areas. Well, for God's sakes, like we don't know this, New Orleans is below sea level. And this clown who lionized and idolized Bobby Brady, pork chops and applesauce, wants to further that? Even the pissant attempts at recovery that have gone on, Hurricane Katrina, cost the nation $80 billion, killed thousands, displaced 1 million people. The agricultural damage in Louisiana alone from Katrina and Rita was $1.6 billion. And Piyush Jindal wants to make sure that happens some more. What's that phrase that Reverbo's been using lately? It's a bozo explosion. the bozos are trying to kill us. And these are the ones who get the lion's share of the time. Holy smokes. In the media. Places like Meet the Prestitutes. It is amazing to say the very least. I also mentioned earlier in the program a little something coming out of the Republican Party. Might find this interesting. It comes out of Illinois and its Republican Party. There is a really creepy bastard running for Senate in Illinois in the GOP primary, named Andy Martin. Now, Andy Martin is the guy who basically pushed and got started the Obama is a Muslim smear, the Muslim blood libel, if you will. He's also made, but he's equal opportunity in his hate because he's made a bunch of anti-Semitic remarks, too. Well, now he has an ad out against his primary opponent, another Republican, a guy named Representative Mark Kirk. This is what Martin says. Martin's the creep. Well, I mean, they're both Republicans. What do you want? But Martin is the bigger creep. And he says, "I'm fighting for the facts about Mark Kirk. Illinois Republican leader Jack Rosser, R-O-E-S-E-R, Smith, says there is a solid rumor that Kirk is a homosexual. Rosser suggests that Kirk is part of a Republican Party homosexual club. Lake County, Illinois Republican leader Ray True says Kirk has surrounded himself with homosexuals. Mark Kirk should tell Republican voters the truth." Wow. And here's the funny part. This creep is a former journalist. In 1996, he ran for a... Wow, he got from Florida to Illinois. How about this? In 1996, Andy Martin ran for a Florida State Senate seat. And, you know, if you're going to do that, you have to have a campaign committee, right? It's paid for by the committee to elect Bob Smith. You know? Well, here's the name of Andy Martin's campaign committee in 1996. The Anthony R. Martin Trigona Congressional... Okay, let me see if I can do that professionally. The Anthony R. Martin Trigona Congressional Campaign to Exterminate Jew Power in America. Whoop! He went bankrupt in 1983, Martin did. And that's when he called the judge, and this is a quote taken, I believe, from the court transcript. "A crooked, slimy Jew who has a history of lying and thieving common to members of his race." You know what? I'm going to go against the grain on this one. I want this guy to win the Republican nomination. I want the Republican Party to wear him like an albatross, like a millstone around their necks. "Hey, Andy, tell us about the Jews and the Muslims." "Oh, they're colluding against us poor little white people." "Tell us again, Andy. Here, say it right into the camera, right into the microphone, Andy. America's watching." Oddly enough, this really is the funny part, damned if the Illinois Republican Party hasn't come out again and demanded that Andy Martin withdraw his gay smear against Mark Kirk. Now, let's just be Oh, and by the way, I love this part. A line from Sam Stein over at Huffington Post. The CD spot seems to take a page out of the Karl Rove playbook. Yeah, we started the program with Karl Rove and his sham marriage of 26 years busting up today. Eric Elk is campaign manager for Mr. Kirk. He said the ad is not true and is demeaning to the political process. The people of Illinois deserve better. This is... Golly, Ned. Oh, seriously, I really, really want this guy to win the nomination. Maybe we can get... Maybe Sarah Palin can come and campaign for him. Wouldn't that be lovely? Because, and I'll say this, look, how hard is this to figure out? Whether his opponent is gay or straight or bi or asexual or you know, any combination of whatever. It has no bearing on his ability to represent the Repiglicans in Illinois. By the way, Martin put this thing out there in Illinois at a time when Kirk is unavailable for comment due to the fact that he's on active duty over the holidays with U.S. Naval Intelligence. Oh, please let Mr. Martin win that primary. Indeed. By the way, this just breaking, totally separate subject, this sort of odds and ends wrapping up before we knock off for the night. This is just breaking, according to the New York Times. It is being reported that two officials, whatever that word means, say the United States government had intelligence from Yemen before Christmas that leaders of a branch of, you know, Al-Qaeda were talking about a Nigerian being prepared for a terrorist attack. How do you like that? Oh, dear. Frustrating. It would be nice, wouldn't it? It would be nice if we could figure out some way to deal with that issue in an open and honest manner. But don't count on it. Witness the following exchange. Get your anti-emetics ready. The following exchange between Ben Stein and Ron Paul, along with Sheila Jackson Lee in the middle, on CNN this evening. The fine folks over at Crooks and Liars posted this. You've got to listen to it. This is from Larry King Live, The Talking Suspenders.
First to the Congresswoman,
yeah,
and then
yes,
Ben.
I do. Yeah, I do. The one Ron thing Paul. That is missing here is never asking the question, what is the motive? Mutulo Magalo, you know, he said why he was, he did it. He said it because we bombed Yemen 2 weeks ago. That was his motive. Osama bin Laden said that he has a plan for America. First, he wants to bog us down in the Middle East in a no-win war. He wants to bankrupt this country, demoralize us, as well as have us do things that motivate people to join his radical movement. It seems like we have fallen into his trap. And if we only, you know, why is it off base? Today, when the gentleman indicated that he did it because of the bombing, you know what the administration said?
Just a question. Has Ben Stein already been embalmed? I can't tell.
If you dismiss motivations for why they hate us, we can never resolve this. There's hate on both sides. But you have to ask the question, why do they hate? And they usually come up with a reason, and we're foolish not to take that into consideration.
Ben? Well, that's Ben. I never heard anything quite like that in my whole life. What he's saying basically is we are doing something wrong by defending ourselves. Look, if these terrorists are trying to kill the government of Yemen, we've got to help defend them. They're our friends. We can't just let Al-Qaeda run wild. If we try to stop them, that's not sufficient provocation. Why should we stop them?
Why?
Because they're terrorists and murderers, and they're very anti-American.
Why should we stop terrorists and murderers?
Well, surely, Larry, Congressman, you... What do you think they're
Why are they terrorists?
They're terrorists and murderers because they're psychos. They're terrorists and murderers.
They're terrorists because we're occupiers.
But we're not occupiers. That's the same anti-Semitic argument we've heard over and over again.
Oh, God, anybody who ever delivered a cold cup of coffee to Ben Stein is an anti-Semite. Saying that we are occupiers is an anti-Semitic argument? What? Help? A little, please. Sheila Jackson Lee, don't you have something to say, dear?
Now that is a vicious attack.
Look, Larry, I'd like to respond to some of these points that he made.
All right, let's go back to Sheila.
We don't need to get into that.
I think I can referee between the congressman and Ben.
Look at this, two Republicans going at it. This is fascinating. With a Democratic liberal in the middle looking at gas.
I can referee between the two of them.
Jesus.
This guy walked on the airplane with this.
Listen to the professional media.
Let me referee, please.
All right, Sheila, say something. All right.
Yeah, let me referee, please. That is interesting.
Both have good points, right?
Well, they have good points, but let me clarify and try to say that Congressman Paul has a point on our positions that we took in Iraq. Which obviously created a very terrible atmosphere, and we all asked the question, what were the results? And, of course, Afghanistan is still a question, but we must be reminded that the terrorists acted under President Bush's clock, and so this can't be an issue of a president's inactivity, per se, and lack of commitment to the homeland. But we have to do better, and I believe we need to have behavioral assessment. There was no reason for this individual to have a visa that still was in place until 2010 for them to be able to travel. There was no reason for him not to be detected because of his behavior, behavioral assessment. We need to make the homeland security of the nation focus. Secretary of Homeland Security should be the point person, and that person should establish a roadmap that then allows us to fund and to put resources accordingly. And finally, the president should put in place...
Okay, before any more screaming ensues, let's get a voice of reason here. I mean, you know, that's just behavioral assessment. That's just crazy talk. So let's go to, like I said, a voice of reason. Let's go to Pat Buchanan. This is from Morning
Joe. Spencer, on the flip side of it, I mean, understanding that you think that the Gitmo has not ultimately
Spencer Ackerman
to benefit the national security interests of this country, I mean, Pat does raise a point. They would have had a lot better luck interrogating this young man if they had made him an enemy combatant and not immediately indicted him, as you pointed out, where he gets all the rights and privileges of the U.S. citizen, all those legal privileges. I mean, what's your argument to that?
Well, is that really true? I mean, we've seen that we've gotten a whole lot of bad information from torturing people. I don't really understand the argument that because every single time we have a new emergency, we have to forget about the hard lessons we've learned in the past over this. And then secondly, by every standard that we've seen so far, every piece of reporting, the guy cooperated. He immediately said he was a member of Al-Qaeda. He started talking in a threatening manner about how there were other attacks coming. So I'm not really sure where we, you know, make this jump to the idea that we're not getting information from the guy. Certainly that's not what Jan Napolitano said. That's not what President Obama said. And that's not what anyone has alleged, really, outside of the show.
Hey, go ahead, Pat.
Well, what I'm saying is the first and highest priority when you apprehend him
is not to make sure he gets his constitutional rights, he's not even a citizen, but to get all of the information you can about where he came from, who trained him, where they are there other attacks coming, where are they coming, and if that means, frankly, you have to deny him pain medicine because it has badly burned, I think you go ahead and do that. I'm not arguing for torture, but I am arguing, nobody is, but I'm arguing for hostile interrogation of this fellow because...
Okay, there's a big difference between torture and hostile interrogation. Hostile interrogation with his head in the toilet, perhaps, Pat? Oh, no, he already said the guy was badly burned, so he wants to hostily interrogate him by withholding pain meds. I think Pat's Brooks Brothers black Oxfords are just a little bit too tight these days, don't you?
Our job is to protect American lives. It's not to make sure his Miranda rights haven't been violated.
So you're arguing for torture, but with a different euphemism for it.
Well, no, I'm arguing for the fact that this is an enemy soldier who's
no, he's not.
Who tried to commit a mass atrocity, and the idea that you're treating him like some guy that held up a 7-Eleven, it seems to me preposterous. We are at war, in a war on terror, and the criminal justice system
yep,
for
we're
American
at war with a noun.
Is a different thing.
Go ahead, Spencer.
Yeah, maybe someday we can get Sarah Palin as president and we can make war on the adjectives, verbs, and adverbs while we're at it. For the love of God. You know, sometimes I hear stuff like this and I just think we're screwed. But there's always the hope that we're not. And frankly, the hope that we're not resides in the fact that we have... you're out there. There has to be some people who are ready to pick up the pieces when these idiots have done their worst. And by idiots, I mean the Ben Steins and Pat Buchanans of the world. You know, have we completely forgotten? They had 8 years to do it their way. And they still, and the other side still hates us because they did it their way. Maybe it's time to try to do it a different way? Crazy liberal that I am. So that's the show for this evening. Thank you very much for stopping by and hanging out. Thanks for your calls, your conversation, your emails, your ideas, your participation in the chat room. Thank you for helping the horn hang on by its traditional hangnail, and continue broadcasting. We've made it almost through December, and with any luck at all, we'll get January too. Thanks, as always, go out to all our chat room moderators, to ELO, to Lottie, to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, to our blogger, Texas Betsy. A special thanks to Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org, to John Fox, to Peter Godbold, and always thanks, many thanks, to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Okay, I may need significant help to get through the program this evening. There is a very specific broadcast term for a day like this, or a week like this. There's a reason folks take vacations during this week of the year. This is what you call a slow news day. Slow, slow, slow. But you know what? There's plenty of interesting stuff out there. That just means you have to work a little bit harder to find it. This is a chance to sort of, because there's no, did I miss it? Is there a new breaking the Tiger Woods story? No, I didn't think so. That's how slow the news day is. But, no, just nonetheless, there's stuff to occupy our attention plenty good as it is. A little bit of breaking news out there today. It's a sad day in family values land. It's a grief-stricken day for family values Republicans. One of those model marriages, one of those Ozzie and Harriet Ward and June marriages, has come to an end. Yes, yes. It has been confirmed that Karl Rove and his wife, Darby, have obtained and had finalized a divorce. Yes, yes, I know, it is sad, but it is also, well, it's just true. Carl and Darby Rove, model couple, a pair who fairly defined traditional family values merge, have called it quits. They've been married since 1986. My God, they were married for almost 24 years. And they've got one son to show for it. And now they're bailing. Really? I mean, I'm not going to sit in a glass house and throw stones or anything, but, you know, the statistics out there say that if you make it past year 5, you've got a better than average chance of staying married. 24 years? And a fine, upstanding follower of Christ like Darby and Karl Rove, and that's done? You know, I think we probably need legislation out there. We need a real Defense of Marriage Act. We need a Defense of Marriage Act out there that will stop these offenses to traditional marriage. Why couldn't these two just stay on in a lifelong, loveless marriage that was a living hell for both of them? Why not? Of course, then again, you never know. One or the other may have been romping, and being as how it's Karl Rove, and they're kind of he's kind of reptilian, you don't know what he or Darby were a romping with now, do you? According to a statement made by Dana Perineal to CNN, the couple came to the decision mutually and amicably,
and they maintain a close relationship and a strong friendship. There will be no further comment, and the family requests that its privacy be respected.
Bug spray. What right do they have to have their privacy respected when Karl Rove was an active participant in an ongoing assault on the private family matters of people all over this country for 8 long years? Just say. No, that's the Republican Party. Do as I say, not as I do. Never mind the fact that I'm over here taking a big old pee on traditional family values and traditional Christian heterosexual marriage. Y'all just need to attend to your own affairs and let us sit over here and be as hypocritical as hell ourselves. Got the memo? Good. Good for you. That's nice. Almost 24 years and nothing to show for it. Wonder who's getting the fabulous wagon wheel coffee table or the family Bible. Well, I'm sorry, I guess in the case of the Rove family, it would be the family Necronomicon. Maybe this is sleazy on my part, and I ought not be noting it. But we're dealing with hypocrites here, right? Juanita's broken out and gone comedy writer on us. Regarding Rove, does this mean George finally said yes? I have a feeling Juanita's at the top of her game tonight. Yes, Carl. Yes, 1,000 times yes. You had me at hello. I'm sorry. That's just that was a full body shiver that just rolled over me. But no, it's a little slow today, but I got a feeling there's plenty of stuff to keep us interested as we go along. A little bit of work having been done to note the fact that in the year 2009, get this, in the year 2009, according to the Washington Monthly, author Steve Bannon, 2009 saw Newt Gingrich. Be the show's most frequent guest of the whole year. Can you imagine that? It's 2009. Democrats have taken over the House. Democrats took over the Senate. Democrats took over the executive branch. And who was the go-to guy for Meet the Press? A worn-out, tired, corrupt, philandering political hack from Georgia who hasn't held office in over 10 years. That's the go-to guy for the for-profit media and that incisive program, Meet the Prestitutes. Not one time, Steve Bannon notes, not one time in 2009